Bob, the whole shock and awe.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking with author Michael Hudson about his book, The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis. We're also going to talk about his article, Countrywide Protected Fraudsters by Silencing Whistleblowers, Say Former Employees. Look, at the end of this whole banking crisis, greed, criminal activity, fraud, abuse, all of that. Michael Hudson will be here to talk about it. In the second hour, Jim Byrne, chairman of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party, going to be here talking about the party's plan moving forward and this whole scheme with Dominic Pileggi and Tom Corbett to really, I mean, the big rig is in. The fix is in. They want to steal Pennsylvania and hand it to the Republican Party without vision, without leadership, without an idea how to fix our economy, without any help. I mean, there's no vision there. There's no there. So what they have to do is they have to steal it. Got to rig the vote. Got to suppress the vote. The whole scheme. So that's what we'll talk to him about. Also in the second hour, Mary Batari, director of the Real Economy Project at the Center for Media and Democracy. She's going to be here talking about Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker and asking the question, is he the John Doe the FBI is investigating? This could be something huge, but the sad reality is all of the damage, all of the criminal stuff that's gone on, all of the pain and suffering this guy has caused, there's nothing we can do about it. At this point, there's almost nothing we can do. We're going to have to fight from behind and begin to undo some of that stuff. So we'll see what she's got to say. Also in the third hour, Deborah Berger is going to be here, president of the 85,000-member California Nurses Association. They took to the streets today some 23,000 of those members to strike against poor conditions for patients and also to have a voice to stand up for their patients. So it'll be interesting talking here. Of course, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So the folks from SEIU are in town tonight. Welcome to the area. They're having their conference over at the Hershey Center, so I just want to give a quick shout-out to those folks. There is a rally tomorrow in Hershey. Noon, I believe it's going to be, so come on out and say hello and show support. Also, there was a rally this afternoon for the Armstrong ceiling tile workers. That went really well. Some 150-some people showed up, so good for them. Tonight, the big GOP debate, another one. I think I've had just about enough. There's not much more insanity. There's not much more craziness that I can see come up, but you know what? They may surprise me. So, again, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Today, oddly enough, today was the day that the Emancipation Proclamation was signed back in 1862. And, you know, kind of the reason I bring this up is yesterday, and I really thought that the saner members of our society would have stepped forward and said, you know what, there are too many questions around this Troy Davis. There are too many questions around his conviction. There's too many questions around whether he's guilty or not. Let's hold off the execution. And they did, from 7 o'clock until 11 o'clock, at which point they put the needle in his arm and the state of Georgia killed him. But, you know, I look at this and I'm not happy what happened today. I'm not happy with what happened. Clarence Thomas, you know, did you expect him to come out and stop this? The answer is no. I just have way too many questions. And, again, this is one of those things, it's permanent. You can't go and undo this. And the other part that really bothers me, and, you know, I think I was pretty clear the other night, and to be honest, I think I was. 7 of the 9 people who testified against this guy have either recanted their story or changed it. There was no evidence, no gun, no weapon, no fingerprints, no DNA, nothing. And yet they still moved forward. And, you know, I look at the people who came out against it. You know, the Pope came out against it. You know, Jimmy Carter, a whole bunch of conservatives came out against it. People like Bob Barr, who extremely conservative, libertarian presidential candidate. He said, quote, there has been very substantial evidence of innocence that has been raised in this case. And I don't think that it's morally or legally correct for the state of Georgia to execute a man against whom there is very substantial evidence of innocence. And, you know, you look at this, and again, I go back to this, 7 of the 9 people, 7 of the 9 have recanted or changed their stories. What does that say about us? And what bothers me also is the method in which, I mean, you have this guy pretty much strapped down at 7 o'clock. Oh, well, we're going to hold on to this for a little bit. And that whole night, I have a problem with the whole thing. Now, oddly enough, on this exact same day, which, you know, I guess we've become the execution capital of the world, they put to death the guy who, Lawrence Russell Brewer, the guy who drugged James Byrd to his death, chained him to the back of a pickup truck and pulled him. He was put to death and he had no final statement. And, you know, I don't think anybody will miss him. Again, I'm still not in favor of the death penalty, but I don't think anybody's going to miss him. And it's odd. You know, I was watching a report on this, and it was really odd to me is that the family of the man who was murdered, that Troy Davis was convicted of murdering, his family, even with all of the uncertainty, headstrong. You know, not, and I don't know that I would feel any differently, but very headstrong, yes. We want him put to death. We're not going to move on this. The people who their loved one was dragged like a piece of meat behind a truck and killed in one of the most heinous ways. That family said, we really don't want this to happen. And it was kind of an odd scenario for me. But in looking at this, this thing in Georgia, the part that caught my attention, besides all of the other stuff that we've talked about, is that this, and I didn't know this was going on. This is one of those things that I didn't realize we had already privatized. You know, I know we've been privatizing our prisons. I know we've been privatizing our roads and our bridges. We've been privatizing everything. I didn't realize that we were privatizing our executions. I didn't know that we had for-profit executioners. I didn't know we had private for-profit executioners. And now in this corporate prison industrial complex, you've got a company like Correct Health. Stop and think about that for a second. It's called Correct Health. I mean, it would only be more Orwellian if it was Long Life Health. the people who decided to put him, who were in charge of putting him to death. They're supposedly a medical company, and they oversee all of the executions in Georgia. And I go, you know, really, you're going to make a pile of money? And somewhere I saw it was like $18,000 to kill this guy. And I'm going, that is an extraordinary amount of money. We couldn't do it in-house for any less than that? And these folks over at the Southern Center for Human Rights, evidently they have now come out and filed a complaint against Correct Health because of the drugs. Now, these drugs are really hard to get because I think the company that was making them here has slowed production. They're moving, if I remember right, somewhere in Italy, and they're not going to allow them to produce it anymore. And they can't get it from the EU because they have this thing that, well, it's being used for the death penalty, so we can't allow it to be exported. So evidently this doctor got a hold of these drugs. And, you know, they sold some to a couple other states, but used them. And now these folks are saying, you know, there's something wrong here. We need to hold these people accountable. The Georgia Composite Medical Board needs to look into this and revoke this doctor's license, they're saying, because they're saying it's illegal for him to use this drug, sodium thiopental. Which is what they use to, you know, to basically stop the heart, I guess. And, you know, good luck on it. I don't think it's going to happen. You know, state-sanctioned murder is going to continue, like it or not, and they're going to get the drugs needed. But at least somebody is doing something. But to me, that part of this really opens up something huge. We are now privatizing executions, something that, you know, the state, I would think, should be really in control of. Are we going to then privatize the execution board so we get more executions and faster so we can have more profit? I mean, is this the direction we're heading? Because we've been doing that with prisons for a very long time. We've been doing it for an awful long time. And now what do we got? We got more people in jail. We got bigger prisons. We got tougher laws, longer sentences. We got all of that stuff. And you know, I saw an article, it was titled something along the lines of Davis is executed, but the 29 CEOs who caused the deaths of 29 miners are still walking around. And I was thinking about them. Yeah, I mean, this guy, with all of the extenuating circumstances, with all of the what ifs and all of the maybes and all of the questions, you still got a CEO walking around who caused the death of 29 miners. You've still got a CEO who caused the death of 11 Deepwater Horizon workers. And not to mention all the banksters that have ruined the lives of so many people by doing some of the things in the banking industry that have caused that to collapse and caused all those people to lose their homes. And I don't know if anyone's done any studies on what's happened or done any following of the people who've lost their homes. What are the suicide rates? What are the crime rates? What are all of the negative social impact things that could be happening? But when we come back, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Michael Hudson's going to be here. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But moreover, this idea of at Countrywide, were they protecting the fraudsters? Were they protecting people who were literally cutting paper and pasting it to other paper to make loans look like they actually are legit? Amazing stuff. Right back after this with Michael Hudson. Stick around.
To the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Thousands of Tyson poultry workers are celebrating a victory for justice on the job in a $32 million legal settlement. More than 17,000 workers at 41 Tyson plants in 12 states will finally get paid for work they did. The legal battle to win the settlement took 12 years. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union filed lawsuits to collect wages for workers who were not paid for the time spent taking gear on and off. The lawsuit settlement means about $1,000 for each worker, including current and former Tyson poultry workers. UFCW President Joe Hansen says every American deserves to be paid for the work they do. This case illustrates one of the benefits of workers having a union voice on the job. The unionization of child care workers is making headlines in two states this week. Jesse Russell reports.
In Connecticut, Governor Dan Malloy has signed two executive orders that will make it possible for family child care providers and personal care attendants to organize. Malloy issued a statement restating his belief in the rights of workers to organize and collectively bargain. In Minnesota, the Republican-controlled legislature is planning to hold hearings regarding efforts of in-home child care workers to organize, while Democratic Governor Mark Dayton has called the hearing a waste of the taxpayers' money. The Republicans said the hearings are necessary to address concerns raised by parents. Dayton could sign an executive order similar to the one signed by Malloy in Connecticut, but he's made it clear he has no intention of doing so. Instead, Dayton wants the 11,000 workers to cast a new vote expressing their desire to organize or not.
Wisconsin Republican Congressman Paul Ryan, appearing on a right-wing radio talk show this week, supported Texas Governor Rick Perry's monstrous lie that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. When asked if Social Security is a Ponzi scheme, Ryan responded, "That is how those schemes work." We already know Ryan wants to end Medicare as we know it and replace it with vouchers to buy private insurance. Now he's venturing out onto even thinner ice by comparing Social Security to a Ponzi scheme. Whatever his opinion about Social Security, it's clear it is not a Ponzi scheme. The Securities and Exchange Commission definition of a Ponzi scheme is a, quote, investment fraud that involves the payment of purported returns to existing investors from funds contributed by new investors. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is cancer. This isn't a sudden crisis that's going to erupt out of the ground like some monster trying to eat us. This is a slow, wasting process.
I kept the promise till the vow got broke. I had to drink from the laughing cup. Stood on the banks till the river rose up. I saw the bride in her wedding gown. I was in the house when the house burned.
Well, you know, we don't do something about this mortgage crisis, the entire house will burn down. And what bothers me, not so much as being done, and in my opinion, we haven't done enough to lock people up. There should be a constant perp walk of people who broke the law, of people who, these greedy banksters who caused this crisis. We should be building a wing on the San Quentin. Just a personal thought. Anyway, this, you know, cause, we know what the fraud's out there. We know what was going on. You just have to prove it. And some people are doing that. Michael Hudson has written a great book, The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned Global Crisis. He's also written a great article, Countrywide Protected Fraudsters by Silencing Whistleblowers, according to former employees. Michael, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on.
You know, the frame that I keep hearing is that the Community Reinvestment Act forced these banks to give those people, those minorities, those poor people loans, and they crashed the housing market.
You know, the facts really don't support that. Nobody, and I think most folks realize that. You know, nobody tells Citibank and Bank of America and Wells Fargo and Chase Manhattan what to do. They tend to tell government officials what to do. And the truth is, the Community Reinvestment Act, you know, in terms of subprime loans, only a small percentage of subprime lenders were even covered by the Community Reinvestment Act. And then, of course, the other thing is the idea that Fannie and Freddie forced these lenders to do this. But, of course, Fannie and Freddie, during when all this, you know, bad behavior was going on, their share of the market, of the mortgage market, went from 55%, where they were dominant, to 35%, which is still a lot, but you could see they were actually going down in influence during, you know, this sort of period of 2005 through 2000, of 2003 to 2005, 2006. And the other thing is 6% over the 8-year period leading up to the financial crash, 6% of Fannie and Freddie backed loans went bad. That's a lot, and that's too much, and that showed that Fannie and Freddie got too reckless and, you know, made some bad choices.
Right.
But by contrast, during that same period, 27% of Wall Street backed loans went bad. So
wow.
Wall Street backed loans were 4.5 times more likely to go bad than Fannie and Freddie loans.
And why is that? I mean,
that's not defending Fannie and Freddie, but it's just saying that they essentially played a secondary role in this. They contributed to the problem. There are a lot of people with Fannie and Freddie, you know, back loans that are facing foreclosure and suffering, but the vast majority of the bad practices were done by lenders that were selling their loans not to Fannie, not to Freddie, but to Wall Street.
So, you know, in looking at that, you know, because I was reading through your article, and to me, I get it. And this is what I've been saying for the longest time. We had an unregulated market, but more importantly, we had people who were out there doing some pretty unscrupulous things. And you pointed out at one point where they were literally cutting pieces of paper and literally pasting them, not just computer cut and paste, but actually making up their own documents.
Right. At AmeriQuest, which is one of the companies I focus on in my book, the joke was, they don't really make enough money. Let's send that back to the art department. Let's send it back to the lab. Because there always was somebody in there who knew how to, you know, basically fabricate fake a document. At Countrywide, the chief fraud investigator that I spent a lot of time interviewing, she talked about how one of the first things they would do is they would go into the shred bin and start looking. And one of the things they found when they raided a bunch of offices in Boston was mock-ups where someone had printed out a computerized appraisal of one piece of property, cut out the address, and then put it on another appraisal of a completely different piece of property so they could make it look like it was worth more and they could push the loan through.
Yeah, and according to your article, and this just, I mean, this is just blatant. You pointed out that they took a dairy foreman and said that he was earning $126,000 a year when in actuality he was making just $13,000 a year.
Right. They gave him an 800% raise, essentially. And of course, it was pointed out in the legal documents that you know talked about this case that this guy turned in his correct income. He gave his records. He gave his he gave information showing that he was making 13 grand a year. But the company went ahead, and I've talked with a lot of people who worked in the industry, and they'll tell you yes, there were some bars who knew that they were inflating their income and kind of were part of it and played along. But lots of times the bars had no idea. They would do what they thought you were supposed to do. Turn over their W-2s, their pay stubs, their tax returns, and think everything was on the up and up. And then, the people on the inside who were really the ones who controlled the process. They were the ones who knew how much income needed to be stated to prove the loan. They were the one who knew how much you had to inflate the appraisal to get the loan through and get Wall Street to buy it. They were the ones that were controlling the process and would push these things through.
Yeah, I go back to someone I knew several years back who ran through this whole problem. They took her, the year she had the most overtime, made that her yearly salary. They went and they did some creative appraising so that they could appraise the house for more, so that the seller could then kick back more money to her. It was really just a whole bunch of creative, in my opinion, should be criminal things that went on, and eventually she did lose the house. But here again, you know, it's this whole scheme where they're all in it. The realtors are in it because they get a higher commission. The appraisers are in it because they keep working, and then these mortgage people were in on it too, because as soon as they wrote the mortgage, they sold it off, so they weren't the ones holding it.
You know, there was a when you mentioned appraisers, there was a petition online, and as far back as I remember looking at it in late 2008. And I think at that time I might have had 8,000 names or 10,000, but it was a petition by appraisers, signed by appraisers, complaining that there needs to be a national investigation because honest appraisers were being blackballed and rubber stamp appraisers, the ones that were inflating property values at, mainly at the behest of the lenders, were getting all the work.
Now, so, I remember when I did a refinance. They were supposed to send an appraiser out, and he said he drove by. He drove by, took a picture, and it was a blurry picture at that. And, you know, I never spoke to anyone. Everything was done on the internet. I mean, it was really just in looking back, a very troubling process, because I could have written anything down. They didn't ask for documentation. They didn't ask for anything. I could have written anything down.
Well, you know, one of the fraud investigators for another one of the big subprime lenders that I talked to said he had questions about some houses, some loans that have been made in one, you know, sort of near same address, but near, you know, seemed to be in a subdivision or same development. So he sent he hired an appraiser who was like out in Indiana to go out to these addresses and check them. I just want to make sure. And he gets a phone call from, you know, I guess on the appraiser's cell phone. He says, I just want to check the address because, you know, I'm standing in front of a cornfield.
Nice.
And when he went back and looked at the loan files even more closely, it turned out that there was one picture of one house, and there was, you know, multiple quote unquote appraisals that had initially been turned in with the same picture.
Jeez.
So.
Wow. I thought you were going to say it was in front of a cardboard box or something.
No, I mean that was the kind of thing that went on, and I want to say this, and I know, you know, this is a basically labor radio and folks there are interested in workplace issues. One of the things that my reporting on Country Ride and on many other big banks and mortgage companies has shown me is that the great, you know, mortgage meltdown wasn't just a consumer story. It was a labor story too. My reporting has showed that companies that abuse their customers also abuse their workers.
Yep.
You know, partly it's because a company with bad, you know, bad ethics isn't going to care about its employees any more than it does its customers. But it's also because to get lots of people to do really bad stuff over a long period of time, it takes more than playing to people's greed. There has to be a level of abuse and intimidation and pressures and mechanisms to brainwash people and persuade people what they're doing is okay. Oh, these people have bad credit. They're deadbeats. They were irresponsible. So, yeah, we're overcharging them and slipping in hidden fees, but we're doing them a favor. And you also have a mechanism, and that's what's being alleged by former employees at Countrywide. You also have to have a mechanism to weed out the honest people, the people who try to say, wait a minute, we can't commit fraud. We can't do this. No, I'm not going to forge signatures on these loan documents. I'm not going to do that. And I basically, either in interviews or in court records, identified 18 former Countrywide employees who said that they were either fired or demoted for objecting or reporting fraud. And, of course, one of them, a lot of the story is about the former chief of mortgage fraud investigations who did her job, she says, found lots of fraud all over the country, and began to believe that it wasn't just a branch-level issue. It was an issue with higher-ups who were protecting the fraud, including the employee relations department that she alleged was, instead of protecting whistleblowers, was actually outing whistleblowers and then terminating. She just won a $930,000 award from OSHA, from the Department of Labor, through OSHA's the whistleblower protection program.
Yeah, it would have been nice if that would have happened, you know, a couple of years back, and maybe stopped this kind of thing from happening back when she was talking about it.
Well, and the thing is, I think, you know, one of the questions for me was, why weren't there more people who came out and talked? Because these kind of practices were an open secret in the real estate industry, in the mortgage industry, in the banking industry.
Yep.
Why weren't there more people? Now I wrote about AmeriQuest back in early 2005, before other people were really, a lot of people had even heard of subprime. And I was able to track down a lot of ex-employees, and most of them were like really happy to talk to me. It seemed like they wanted to talk. And I had people saying, I'm really glad to be able to tell you the things that I did, or the things that I was forced to do, or the things that I saw going on in my branch and that's why I quit, or that's why I was fired.
Yeah, I knew a guy not too long ago. I coached my kid's baseball team, and he was one of the fathers there. And he said that, you know, he had never been a mortgage person. He had some legal problems, had a background. Someone pulled him in and basically trained him from the bottom, that he thought all of this stuff was how it was done. I mean, in as you pointed out, it is a worker issue, but this is how he was trained in it. He said, you know, after some time, you got to the point where, is this right? Am I doing? And he said, eventually, he had to get out of it.
Right, and that was the thing at AmeriQuest. They hired people who their ideal person was someone who had a little bit of sales experience, maybe working at Radio Shack, somewhere like that, but had no mortgage experience because they wanted to train them their way. And I talked to them. I talked to these young guys. They're mostly guys, again and again, and they said, yeah, you know, they told me it was okay. They said, well, these people have terrible credit, so, you know, yeah, we're charging them a lot, and maybe they don't know about all the fees. Maybe they don't understand that it's an adjustable rate, but we're still doing them a favor. They couldn't get a loan anywhere else. And they came to realize that they were taking advantage of people, and they actually realized that a lot of these customers didn't have bad credit, but they had manipulated them into getting, you know, that was one of the you know, one way of, you know, one form of predatory lending is lending money to people, more than they can afford,
right,
and gouging them fees. Another way is taking someone with good credit and making them pay subprime, you know, a prime customer and making them pay subprime rate. So instead of paying 5%, you're paying 8.5%, and then it jumps up, in 2 years when the adjustable rate kicks in. And, you know, over the lifetime of a loan, even if you pay it, wait 5 years to refinance, that's a lot of money.
That's an awful, especially since the mortgages are front-loaded, where you're paying most of the interest up front. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Mike Hudson, author of The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis. We've got a link over at TheRickSmithShow.com where you can pick that up. You know, and my friend, who I remember talking to, he said, you know, They sold it to them as, well, these people should know better, and hey, at the end, they still agreed to this. So you're not doing anything. It's them. They know what they're getting into, and that's a pretty powerful message.
Right, and I think, and again, I think there were cases where there were borrowers who were gaming the system. They kind of knew what was going on, although they never knew as much as the insiders, never knew as much as the real estate and mortgage professionals. But, you know, they understood that they were sort of getting over a little bit. I think there were a lot of people like that. There were a lot of street level fraudsters, like real, you know, people who would take out mortgages on houses without the intent, you know, and suck the money out of some inner city property and then take the money and run.
Yeah.
But my reporting and talking to lots of people, and again, talking to lots of, like literally hundreds of people who worked in the industry who can tell you what their customers were like and what they did and you know, what percentage of what kind of customer. The most people were just average folks who were trying to do the right thing.
Trying to live the American dream.
Right. They were adding on to their house or buying a bigger house because their family was getting bigger and they, you know, needed to do that. They were taking money out, you know, in a refinancing because they had unexpected medical bills. And when this happened, quite often lenders laid really elaborate traps for them. And often you would come in and you really wouldn't know what was going on. Often you wouldn't know what was going on until long after you signed the documents. But even if you sat down to sign the documents and you were able to read and kind of get a sense that things were different from what you were promised, often it was too late. If you're buying a house, you may already have all your belongings packed in a truck.
Yep.
And you've moved out of you've given notice in your apartment building and you're waiting to move into your brand new house. And if you realize the interest rate is higher and that kind of thing, it's you have to make a choice between what are you going to do. Or even if it's a refinancing, often what would happen is the lenders would say, well, you know, don't make sure you don't pay your current mortgage payment this month because because we're going to pay it off, and if you make that payment, it's going to mess up the numbers. And then they would postpone it a week or two, and suddenly they're behind on that mortgage, and they sit down at closing, and they've got all these credit card bills that they're worried about, and then they have to make a choice, and it's a really hard choice. Do I go ahead and take this refinancing and pay off these old debts and you know, hope I can refinance out of this terrible loan in 6 months? Or do I push away from the table and say no? And it's a really hard, you know, it's a hard thing. And most folks, I think, felt in those situations, felt trapped and felt like they had to
and pressured into it.
Bite their tongue and do it.
Yeah, like you've got no choice. How much, you know, we keep hearing this talk, we need more deregulation, you know, businesses act in their best interest. How much of this could have been avoided by having the regulations we had back 20 years ago?
Well, there's two things. I think there's regulations, but there's also enforcement of what's on the books. The truth is that the Federal Reserve had many powers to go after bad mortgages, to go after the creditors, to take on the products, the adjustable rate loans, the exploding, you know, rates after 2 years, and the no interest loans, and all these sort of complicated products that even, you know, even really smart consumer lawyers, it would take them hours to read through all the documents and figure out exactly what it all, you know, how all the moving parts worked. You can pass all the laws you want, but if you don't have political will, if you don't have law enforcement, then, you know, nothing's going to happen. But of course, but then, you know, deregulation, and you know, one of the big things that happened was that many of the states, there were a lot of states like North Carolina and Iowa and Minnesota and Washington State that actually were very aggressive about going after a lot of these companies. But what happened, especially if they were subsidiaries of nationally chartered banks, when a state began an investigation, they would go to their federal regulator and say, hey, you know, the state is messing with us. And the federal regulator would go to the state and often sue the state and say, hey, we have sole power over them. We have, you know, federal preemption. You keep your hands off. We'll take care of it. But, of course, the problem – and then the states would have to back off. And, of course, the problem was the federal regulators did take care.
Let me ask you a last question I got before we go
sure.
to break. Are we doing anything to change this? Is this still going on? Is this something that we have to worry about in the future? How much has been done since?
I want to say one thing. If folks want to read my article, I need to put in a pitch for my employer that they go to www.iWatch, that's the letter I, watchnews.org. And to answer your question, not a lot has been done, but there's still people who are fighting, and there's still efforts by attorneys and community groups and some, you know, some lawmakers and some state attorneys general to uncover this, to keep fighting, and to really get to the bottom of what happened and hold people accountable. But there's a lot of fight. Like, again, we're in a scenario where on the foreclosure fraud issues, essentially the federal government is pushing back against the state attorneys general who want to be tougher on the banks and don't want just a quick, relatively cheap settlement, but want to go deeper on this. So it's still a battle, and I think the key is for people to keep informed and be active on the issue and don't sit back and expect it's all going to get fixed.
Yeah, good point. Again, the article's name is Countrywide Protected Fraudsters by Silencing Whistleblowers. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Michael Hudson's name. Tomorrow there's going to be another part of the investigation going to look at the senior executives there and some other things. We'll have a link to that article as well. Again, the book is The Monster, How a Gang of Predatory Lenders and Wall Street Bankers Fleeced America and Spawned a Global Crisis. Of course, we've got the link at thericksmithshow.com. Michael Hudson, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Many thanks, Rick. I really appreciate it.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Now, let's turn the Hubble telescope to the faraway galaxy where Rick, Mitt, Michelle, and Goofy are contending for the Republican presidential nomination. In the GOP's recent debate at the Reagan Library, its seekers of the presidency collectively caused people to gasp and say to themselves, "Gosh, I miss Ronald Reagan's intellect." Especially stupid was the outbreak during the debate of a schoolboy spat between Rick Perry and Mitt Romney over the serious issue of job creation. Let's replay the moment. Romney had boasted of his performance as a job creator during his governorship in Massachusetts, leading to this retort by Perry. "Michael Dukakis created jobs 3 times faster than you did, Mitt." To which Romney shot back, "Well, as a matter of fact, George Bush and his predecessor created jobs at a faster rate than you did, Governor." Mustering all of his wits, Perry parried with this fib, "That's not correct." And Romney struck the last blow by declaring definitively, "Yes, that is correct." Aside from their juvenile inanity, it's revealing to hear the two Republicans brag about having created jobs. "Look at what we've done over the last decade," Perry exclaimed at another point in the debate. "We created 1 million jobs in the state of Texas." We? That's Republican heresy. Indeed, out on the campaign trail, both Rick and Mitt are piously faithful to the GOP's religious dogma, which sternly dictates that government cannot create jobs. Only the magical free market performs that miracle. Believe it or not, though, these two are presently their party's front runners, which is why many Republicans are asking, is that all there is? Well, maybe not. His rootiness, Rudy Giuliani, now says he might jump into the race. Quote, "If I think we're truly desperate." This is Jim Hightower saying, wow, that would be desperate.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
It's class warfare. My class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
A working class hero is something to be.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
Working class hero is something to be.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast there or watch the video. Also, if you've got a smartphone, you can download the Stitcher app and take the program on the go with you. Today, back in 1910, an 18-year-old garment factory worker named Annie Shapiro led the walkout of 17 women at the Hart Schaffner Marx factory there in Chicago, which led to eventually a months-long strike of 40,000 garment workers across the city. They were protesting the length of the days, bullying by bosses, and already low wages. I mean, you know, this is a fight that has been going on since the beginning of people working for each other. You've got long, cruel hours, difficult working conditions, and, of course, bullying bosses who, you know, they don't care about you. All they care about is production. All we want is the bottom line. So how many people saw Fox News' Bill O'Reilly threaten to quit? If they raise my taxes, I'll quit! And remember the Tea Party guy, John Fleming, the representative from Louisiana, saying, "Gee, you know, I only have $400,000 at the end of the year to feed my family. After I feed my family, all I have is $400,000." Oh, I'm sure most people are, you know, their hearts bleed for these guys. When you look at the new poll out, two-thirds of the country, two-thirds. You know, it's hard sometimes to get a large number of people to come together. Two-thirds of the people are saying, "Tax the rich. Look, these are the people who have the money. That's where we go." 66% of Americans told the polling firm that individuals making $200,000 and families over $250,000 should see an increase in their taxes. They should pay higher. And look, the reality is 70% of the people polled said, you know what? Wealthy corporations, they should pay taxes. This whole charade, oh, well, you know, we have the highest tax rate in the world. Nonsense. I was watching a congressional hearing the other day, and one of the people who was testifying said, "Well, it costs us $1 billion, to build a factory, and 90% of that is because of taxes." And I go, "Really, 90% of your $1 billion investment in thing is taxes?" And I haven't really been able to find how that works out. So you build the factory $100 million and $900 million goes to taxes? That doesn't make any sense, but, you know, that's what they threw out. But there's this whole back and forth over class war. Oh, here the Republicans going, "Oh, you're engaging in class war." And the president even, to a degree, saying, "Well, you know, better back off. Well, it's not class war. It's math. It's math." Well, today he came out and he said, well, you know what? If asking the wealthy to pay the same, the same tax rate as a plumber, if that's what class war is, well, that makes me a warrior for the middle class. I'll be happy to do that. I'll wear that with a badge of honor. And finally, somebody, talking the game. I'm very happy about that. Elizabeth Warren, who's running against Scott Brown up in Massachusetts, was on the campaign stump. And, she was talking. And this is the kind of language I think has to happen. This kind of realization that, you know what, the investor class didn't get there on their own. If only I would plug in the, sometimes. Here's the clip.
My favorite part of looking at this whole, we got this whole $1 trillion on tax cuts for the rich under George Bush. We got into this whole $2 trillion on two wars that we put on a credit card for our children and grandchildren to pay off. And we got into this whole $1 trillion on a Medicare drug program that, A, was not paid for, and B, is 40% more expensive than it needs to be because it was a giveaway to the drug companies. So we just have, that's just $4 trillion right there. So part of the way you fix this problem is, don't do those things.
Yeah, it's kind of common sense. Stop doing the things that got us into this mess. The misadventures in the Middle East, the drug thing, go back, renegotiate that. Seems kind of simple to me.
Oh, serious. I hear all this, this is class warfare, this is whatever. No, there is nobody in this country who got rich on his own. Nobody. You built a factory out there, good for you. But I want to be clear, you moved your goods to market on the roads the rest of us paid for. Yep. You hired workers the rest of us paid to educate. You were safe in your factory because of police forces and fire forces that the rest of us paid for. You didn't have to worry that marauding bands would come and seize everything at your factory and hire someone to protect against this because of the work the rest of us did. Now look, you built a factory and it turned into something terrific or a great idea. God bless. Keep a big hunk of it. But part of the underlying social contract is you take a hunk of that and pay forward for the next kid who comes along.
Yeah, just that kind of realization. And look, you could talk class war all day long. The reality is just what she laid out. No one got rich on their own. They did it because we invested in roads and bridges and schools and all of the police force, all of that stuff. Makes sense to me, and I hope the voters of Massachusetts, I hope they get their heads out of the sand. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. Got Mike on line one. How are you doing tonight, Mike?
Yeah, hi, Rick. I was just wondering if anybody had mentioned the name Terry Schiavo with regards to that Tea Party remark of the guy in a coma, let him die.
Yeah, that's a good point. They didn't want her to die.
Not only did they not want her to die, Georgie Bush and the Congress came back out of session and from vacation to sign a bill to keep her alive. And apparently there was some Medicaid funding going to keep her alive.
Excellent, excellent point. I remember Tricky Ricky Santorum running down there for a fundraiser, also to get a photo op down there doing the same thing. That's it.
And he didn't bring up Terry Schiavo as one of the people you didn't want to let die when they said let him die there on that stage, did he?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. They were the ones who were fighting tooth and nail.
Let's start attacking them on their issues.
Excellent point. But here's the thing. I mean, they've got to try and tee it up. They've got to be the Tea Party people so that they get through the primary. And this is one of those issues.
Yeah, I know what you mean there. They're sitting there, The thing is, Sarah Palin was right about the death panels and the health care. And the reason she was right was that the Republican Party is a death ward.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Never mind the insurance companies that were the death panels for the last, however many years. Never mind that.
Try 30 plus.
Yeah. Well, I mean, since we made it for profit. I mean, it used to be a not-for-profit industry.
Phil Donahue hasn't been on TV for over a decade, back in the late 90s. He had on some doctors and some widowers, the survivors of women who had died from breast cancer. And they had wanted to do a procedure, which the insurance companies refused to pay for because they called it experimental. Well, one of the people that they actually paid for it for was one of the executives in the insurance company. She needed the same kind of surgery. They did it for her, but not these other women. And the Donahue program had on all about this and about how the doctors were being instructed not to do these so-called experiments. And like one of the doctors said that if they did the procedure, the lady's chance of living was about 3 in 10. If they didn't do the procedure, it was like 1 in 10 or below.
Wow. So, you know, that's not good enough for them, so let her die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know. But now this has been being done with both parties over 30-plus years. They've been playing with the thing of let's not treat the elderly, let's not treat these people. Let's go back to Nanaka the North movie where when the mother-in-law gets too old to be able to do sewing anymore, she leaves the igloo, goes out, and sits on an ice floe to die.
Yeah, well, I mean, and unfortunately, that's true. That's kind of the discussion that's been going on, but they're doing it around your ability to pay. Well,
yeah.
If you don't have the money, sorry, tough luck. But if you're a billionaire, you get the best care on the planet.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's the thing I think working class people had better wake up to. We're moving to this for-profit private system where there's going to be no safety net. Either you can pay or you die.
Well, part of it's this. They should remember that 30 years ago, working class people didn't pay anything for their insurance. It was provided as part of the contract.
Right. Well, that's when we had strong unions.
And now they started paying half of it or part of it, and now they're going to be paying all of it. And sooner or later, it's not even going to be available.
I mean, look at how well they have divided the working class in this country. They've made them pay for most of their medical costs, and with deductibles and co-pays and all of that, they've taken their pension and made them self-funded, so that workers are the ones who bear the brunt of the downturns, so the criminals on Wall Street can pocket it. I mean, they've really rigged the game. You got to give them credit. We've bought into it.
All those blue-collar Reagan Democrats that committed suicide by voting for it.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid that 2012 is going to be 1980 all over again. The more we look at this, the more afraid I become.
It could well be. If they don't turn around the gas prices, I think it will be, because only once since Ford took the presidency and OPEC formed, has gas prices gone up by a significant amount and the party in the White House not changed. And that was in 2004, and we all know now that the only reason the party didn't change is Georgie cheated in Ohio.
Yeah, they rigged Ohio. Well, the only reason he got elected the first time is they rigged Florida.
Well, he cheated in Florida.
And now look what the Republicans are trying to do here in Pennsylvania. They're trying to rig the game here.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's unconscionable, but you know what? To them, it doesn't matter. It's all about raw power. It's all about pushing through their agenda. And if they get caught in the aftermath, all the damage is done.
There's a quote of Nixon's, and supposedly it was in Time magazine as part of his obituary in 94. And it happened to be that he knew that, I think it was Voorhees, who was the first guy they had beat in running for Congress. Wasn't a pinko, but it was more important to win than to tell the truth.
And unfortunately, with Citizens United, we're going to hear an awful lot of things that aren't true and not know who's telling them.
Yeah.
That's what scares me.
Well, have a good day, then.
I appreciate the call, Mike. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
I look at this, Jake, and the reality is, you know, we're in trouble, and we better get our heads out of the sand, and working people better figure out exactly which direction we're heading.
Well, again, we said this before, and at this point I believe it, although that can change. I think that the saving grace is the Republicans really don't have their act together and could wind up running somebody who's pretty weak. I think that's maybe the one hope that we have right now. Although I have to say, I see a change in attitude of the president. I mean, he took a lot of guff, took a lot of guff from the left, took a lot of guff from actually the Black Caucus in Congress, and I think he's starting to heat it. I just hope that he keeps that up. We shall see.
Yeah, we'll see. Mitt Romney had something interesting to say. And, you know, we talk about this whole class war thing, and I think there absolutely is a class war going on. It's been going on. It's been raging for 30, 40 years. It's just now that I think we're really feeling the pain of it. And I don't know that we're feeling enough of it to get people's heads turned around, but we're feeling it. Mitt was on the stump, and again, you got to hear this.
I think it's a real problem when you have half of Americans that are almost half of Americans that are not paying income tax. Of course, you have a lot of people out of work that aren't going to pay tax. My own view with regards to tax policy is that we ought to provide help to the people who've been hurt most by the Obama economy. And that's the middle class. It's not those at the very low end. It's certainly not those at the very high end. It's for the great middle class, the 80 to 90% of us in this country. And what I would do specifically is this. I would say that everybody who is earning $200,000 a year and less should be able to save their money however they want to and not pay taxes on it, meaning no tax on interest, dividends, or capital gains for middle-income Americans.
No interest, no tax on interest, capital gains, and dividends. Interest, capital gains, and dividends for those making under $250,000 a year. And my other part that I loved, and the great middle class, the 80 to 90% of us. I love that inclusion of us from a guy in the top 1 to 2% of the country. I love that inclusion. But again, you know, where's the focus? Interest, capital gains, and dividends. How much interest did you have last year? How many returns from capital gains did you have last year? How many dividend checks did you receive last year? I would pretty much venture the majority of people have none. Those things are for his class. Not the 80 to 90% of us in this country who that doesn't matter to. We don't have that. Now, in the upper strata where he's from, and now he's trying, you got to give him credit, trying to look like an everyday guy, trying to look like the rest of us. But in his world, that's how people make their living. Off interest from their accounts, off capital gains from their investments, off dividend checks rolling in. It's not through the sweat of their brow or the ache of their back or any of the labor that they do. No, it's pushing a couple of buttons and telling their investor how to move their money around. To them, a hard day's work is moving money from one pocket to the other. That's a hard day's work.
Well, you got to give the president credit. I mean, his proposals for cutting the deficit, I mean, he said we need to look at the Warren Buffett rule. And we talked about this numerous times. Warren Buffett said, hey, you know, my secretaries are paying a higher percentage than I am, which is obscene simply because he makes most of his income in interest and dividend.
And now the right wing's attacking him, saying, well, you should put out your tax returns so we can see. Amazing stuff. You got to give them credit. They know how to turn the screw. They know how to get things diverted. And speaking of diversions, and I'm going to be happy. I'm telling you, I think this thing with Pelleggi and Corbett is a good thing. I'm happy that they're going to take some heat over it. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Pennsylvania Democratic Party Chairman Jim Byrne about the big rig, the big fix. The screw job coming down the road. And I gotta tell you, I hope they push this. I hope they take the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, that are coming their way to push this, because I think the people of Pennsylvania are not gonna put up with it. Right back after this with Jim Byrne. Stick around.
Smith Show.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Thousands of Tyson poultry workers are celebrating a victory for justice on the job in a $32 million legal settlement. More than 17,000 workers at 41 Tyson plants in 12 states will finally get paid for work they did. The legal battle to win the settlement took 12 years. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union filed lawsuits to collect wages for workers who were not paid for the time spent taking gear on and off. The lawsuit settlement means about $1,000 for each worker, including current and former Tyson poultry workers. UFCW President Joe Hansen says every American deserves to be paid for the work they do. This case illustrates one of the benefits of workers having a union voice on the job. The unionization of child care workers is making headlines in two states this week. Jesse Russell reports.
In Connecticut, Governor Dan Malloy has signed two executive orders that will make it possible for family child care providers and personal care attendants to organize. Malloy issued a statement restating his belief in the rights of workers to organize and collectively bargain. In Minnesota, the Republican-controlled legislature is planning to hold hearings regarding efforts of in-home child care workers to organize, while Democratic Governor Mark Dayton has called the hearing a waste of the taxpayers' money. The Republicans said the hearings are necessary to address concerns raised by parents. Dayton could sign an executive order similar to the one signed by Malloy in Connecticut, but he's made it clear he has no intention of doing so. Instead, Dayton wants the 11,000 workers to cast a new vote expressing their desire to organize or not.
Wisconsin Republican Congressman Paul Ryan, appearing on a right-wing radio talk show this week, supported Texas Governor Rick Perry's monstrous lie that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. When asked if Social Security is a Ponzi scheme, Ryan responded, "That is how those schemes work." We already know Ryan wants to end Medicare as we know it and replace it with vouchers to buy private insurance. Now he's venturing out onto even thinner ice by comparing Social Security to a Ponzi scheme. Whatever his opinion about Social Security, it's clear it is not a Ponzi scheme. The Securities and Exchange Commission definition of a Ponzi scheme is a, quote, investment fraud that involves the payment of purported returns to existing investors from funds contributed by new investors. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You know, it concerns me, of course, that the governor and he are for it very quickly out of the gate, but I'm not saying I'm against it yet. I just need to sit there and say to myself, what's this really going to affect, and why are we doing this? We're just trying to do it so that one side has the upper hand over the other. I don't really think that any citizens really stand for that.
It was an inside job. Found a well connection.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So no Jim Byrne tonight. I'm not sure what's going on, but we're going to move along. This whole thing with Pelleggi and Corbett is pretty simple. They don't have the ability to win an election in this state. Their vision, their leadership, their ideas have all failed over the years. So in order to turn Pennsylvania into a Republican state, they can only cheat. You can't win at the ballot box, so you've got to come up with a scheme to cheat. And I hope, and some of the Republicans that I've talked to, they're seeing right through this. Surprisingly, Tricky Ricky Santorum, not overly thrilled with it. A lot of the Republican congressmen kind of not happy, because what this is going to mean is you're going to see some of those districts where you have soft Republican support, you're going to see them gone, and they don't want to lose their jobs. They like their cushy area. They don't want to inflame the nation. And if I'm Corbett, this is really a dumb thing. But I'm, you know, a part of me says I'm glad he's doing it, because what this is doing is it's diverting attention away from everything else. And it's going to really, I think it's going to turn the Republicans angry.
Did they ever stop and think that maybe 10 years in advance it could work the opposite way, where actually they get the majority vote and lose the state, which could happen? You know, anything's, don't say it can't. Anything can happen in politics. I think this is very short-sighted, and I think some of these Republicans are standing back and saying, hey, look, if we do this, it's going to be just like what happened in Wisconsin. You were the center of attention for the whole country, and there was money and resources on both sides in Wisconsin in that fight earlier in the year that came pouring in, and I think that's what you would get in Pennsylvania.
No, I mean, there's some groups out there looking to spend a boatload of money. And look, you know, I guess, you know, the economy could use it. You know, maybe we need the influx of some, you know, Comcast may need a couple extra bucks. So they're talking about spending something. I was reading DeCourcy's article today about $300,000 or more to push this electoral plan, this screw job, the big rig. And I'm going, couldn't we use that $300,000 for education? Couldn't we use that $300,000 in a more constructive way other than destroying our democracy and destroying the nation? Now, look, if you want to talk about going district by district as a nation, okay, let's have that discussion. But to gerrymander on a national level like this just stinks to high heaven.
No, the best thing they can do, in my opinion, you mentioned it, is to go straight vote. Individual with the most votes gets it. Here's another thing, Rick. I think the Republicans are assuming a lot. Some of these swing districts, as in most elections, it's that middle 40%, those independents, those people who register non-party. I think if you do that, I think a lot of those moderates who might even be, at this point, hedging their vote on the Republican side, I think you might be pushing them over for a Democratic vote.
Now, if we want to talk about doing away with the Electoral College, it's worth having a conversation. Like I said, it's worth having the conversation. It should be a winner-take-all system. But the Republicans won't agree to that either. because, look, you know, they know they'll have trouble in the big population areas. And that was one of the reasons against popular vote, is that you would have people paying strict attention only to the states that have the largest population. And the little states would have no representation whatsoever, and no one would ever bother with them, and they wouldn't be players. This way, by having the Electoral College doing the little vote thing, in theory, it was meant to bring people out to those states and give them some power that they don't otherwise have. So, you know, again, you know, I look at this, and I don't know why they chose. If I were the leader of the Republican Party, this would be the last thing I would do. I would be focusing on all of the other all the other stuff that I want to privatize education so I can make a boatload of money off of that. I want to privatize the wine and spirit shop so we can hand that off. I mean, there's so many things that's on their agenda, which is why I'm saying, you know, it's probably a good thing that they're diverting themselves and they're overreaching in such a obvious, blatant fashion. That even their own constituents, even the people who want them to privatize everything, are going, hold on, that's a bit too far. You know, like you heard in the clip coming into this segment, Representative Scott Perry, Republican, way out, you know, on the conservative end here, saying, well, wait a second, we need to stop and, you know, think about this for a little bit. There's a visceral reaction to this kind of blatant overreach.
Well, and right now, with the economy, and you know, if you're paying attention, the market went down again, took a hit. Every time it takes a hit, that makes it that much more difficult for the president. And the general sway of the economy right now is going in Republicans' way, but doing something like this, I really believe, is a major mistake.
Yeah, I mean, because it's blatantly apparent that it is what it is. So how many people have been hearing this Gibson guitar story? I've heard this over and over and over again. Got a couple of emails on this Gibson thing and how, you know, regulations, you know, killing this poor little company, and how their CEO is this, you know, this warrior against regulation. And, you know, when I did a little reading into it and did some, you know, some thinking about it, this company violated the rules. They broke the law. The way I'm reading it, they got this wood from a part of Madagascar, this ebony and this rosewood from Madagascar, and from some other wood from India that was illegally logged. It's not supposed to be here, but they brought it here. They got it here. So when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife agents went in, they took it as evidence in violation of the Lacey Act, which to me, I think is, you know, the more I read about the Lacey Act, I'm going, this is a smart law. It's protecting U.S. jobs because we log here. And by allowing illegal logging to go on, you're undercutting your own industry. So to me, it seems like a smart thing. But again, you know, what they're trying to push, oh, poor us. And it's another one of these situations that I've been talking about. It's not that we broke the law. It's that the law is broken. And this is what they've been arguing. Oh, well, gee, we just don't know what the law is, or, you know, it's too vague. I think they told you. No, but you brought it anyway. And at the end of this, every step of the way, the Fish and Wildlife people dotted their I's and crossed their T's. They went and they got a warrant from a judge before they did anything. And that is exactly what you're supposed to be doing. The warrant was based on a sworn affidavit, constitutional, and they went and they seized what they believed to be anything that was part of this criminal act. I'm not seeing why Gibson Guitar is the one that the Republicans are holding up, the D-Twits are holding up as this icon of deregulation. Do you want people doing things that are illegal? And, you know, the same thing with the Boeing situation. Well, they're creating jobs, yes, but they're doing it in an illegal fashion. This isn't about South Carolina. It has nothing to do with them. It has everything to do with the law. You know, the Law and Order Party, the people who want to keep locking folks up and keep plunging needles into their arms, you would think the Law and Order Party would want to hold the law to everyone, even Mr. Gibson, because evidently now people are corporations, and Mr. Boeing. The difference is Mr. Gibson and Mr. Boeing have a hell of a lot more money than Mr. Davis had before they plunged the needle into his arm yesterday. So they're making this guy out to be some big hero when the reality is they violated the Lacey Act. And that's what they're being accused of. There was a search warrant. There was an affidavit. Well, constitutionally, that's what they did. And I don't know what the complaint is. I really don't. In fact, as I said, this Lacey Act protects our jobs because it's the whole idea of having a floor under your feet. If we're going to go into this whole cutthroat capitalist mentality, this whole free market, the corporations can do whatever they want because they're people, we're going to all live a very, very dangerous life and a very poor one at that because there'll be no floor under our feet. So nothing that comes into this country will have any rule. And that's what worries me. So I'm not getting the Gibson thing, man. Just not getting it. Simple, simple stuff. The Department of Labor is now expanding their enforcement of wage violations, according to the Florida Independent. Hilda Solis signed an agreement with the IRS and with nine states. Again, Connecticut, Maryland, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Missouri, Utah, and Washington. No Pennsylvania. Also, Hawaii, Illinois, and Montana still. No Pennsylvania. And, of course, New York as well. They're going to look into minimum wage violations, overtime pay violations, to look into who's getting the screw job. We've seen for a long time misclassifications. We've seen for a long time the whole, oh, you're an independent contractor. The whole temp thing, which was playing out in, I don't know if you read the article in the morning call from Allentown about Amazon. But Amazon, evidently out there, is just a horrid place to work. I mean, if you think that Hershey factory was bad, this place, evidently they're carrying people out on stretchers, carrying them out on wheelchairs, paramedics in there. Just kind of amazing stuff. And you look at the article, and they said over the past 2 months, the Morning Call had done, you know, 20 interviews with some people who worked there, and the people showed pay stubs, you know, for verifications. And they got a behind the glimpse look at what goes on in this Amazon warehouse. And they, you know, they try to put themselves off as this wonderful corporate citizen. And they say, you know, employees were frequently reprimanded, This is according to the article, because their productivity numbers weren't high enough. They were threatened to be fired if their numbers weren't high enough. If people weren't meeting their goals, it was displayed regularly, the kind of public shame. And as they fired somebody, they would do the perp walk, and they would escort them for everybody to see, so that, you don't want to be him. And the idea, I guess, according to the Morning Call article, is that, you would see this going on. So, if you've got a pain or you've got an injury, you wouldn't say anything because you'd get fired.
Kind of like dead employee walking.
Yeah. I mean, and the sad reality is that this is the American workforce. This is what
non-union, I'm assuming.
Well, all temps.
Wow.
I mean, you think the J-1 thing is bad. These people are the same boat. They make about 11 or 12 bucks an hour. But, they were talking about the heat wave that had just hit, and you're seeing people being wheeled out on a regular basis, suffering from dehydration and heat stress, all of this stuff. So, there was this whole push because of this article. So Amazon has said, well, we'll air condition the building. We don't care about any of the other stuff. And you even had doctors from emergency rooms calling OSHA saying, there's some unsafe conditions going on here. We're getting these people coming in on a regular basis. And, you look at this, and all of the people they talked to were saying, look, I can't lose my job. I can't speak up. I can't do anything. These job openings are scarce. It's $11, $12 an hour. I'm never going to get a job with Amazon. I'm going to work for this Integrity Staffing Solution, another temporary agency. And the more I thought about it, I'm going, this really is the Republican dream workforce. They're exploitable. They're desperate. And we can do whatever we want to them because they're not going to say a word because they need the job. They need to feed their kids. So they're going to put up with the crummy conditions and the fast paced and all the other stuff that goes on with it.
In some ways, it reminds you of the old company town.
Yeah.
To a degree.
And the thing is, they only hire temporary people there. And according to the article, very few people get hired on. So it's, and what they do is they would fire people and then say, oh, well, you can come back and reapply as a temp again. So they keep them perpetually in temporary status, which is nothing new. I mean, this stuff happens all the time. And I'm still amazed that we as a working class put up with it and that we haven't pushed for stronger laws. And I guess, at the end of it, it's this disconnect from us in our workplace and us and our fellow workers. It went on to say that temporary employees interviewed said few people in their working group actually made it to the permanent positions. Instead, they said they were pushed harder and harder to work faster and faster until they were either terminated, they quit, or they got injured. And, you look at this, and it's exactly what you want. You want this high turnover. You want young people, young bodies coming in, busting their behinds for a couple of months until they start breaking down. Then you get rid of them and they move on to the next one and they take their injuries with them. Now OSHA did do an inspection and it went through some of the results of that. But when they did when the employees made the complaint, the heat index inside the building was 102 on the first floor and 50. 15 employees collapsed, had to be taken to the hospital. And you go, problem. So what do? We're not gonna help the workers. We'll air condition it. Just amazing stuff to me. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts after this.
Rick Smith.
Now, let's turn the Hubble telescope to the faraway galaxy where Rick, Mitt, Michelle, and Goofy are contending for the Republican presidential nomination. In the GOP's recent debate at the Reagan Library, its seekers of the presidency collectively caused people to gasp and say to themselves,
Gosh, I miss Ronald Reagan's intellect. Especially stupid was the outbreak during the debate of a schoolboy spat between Rick Perry and Mitt Romney over the serious issue of job creation. Let's replay the moment. Romney had boasted of his performance as a job creator during his governorship in Massachusetts, leading to this retort by Perry. Michael Dukakis created jobs 3 times faster than you did, Mitt. To which Romney shot back, well, as a matter of fact, George Bush and his predecessor created jobs at a faster rate than you did, Governor. Mustering all of his wits, Perry parried with this fib. That's not correct. And Romney struck the last blow by declaring definitively, yes, that is correct. Aside from their juvenile inanity, it's revealing to hear the two Republicans brag about having created jobs. Look at what we've done over the last decade, Perry exclaimed at another point in the debate. We created 1 million jobs in the state of Texas. We? That's Republican heresy. Indeed, out on the campaign trail, both Rick and Mitt are piously faithful to the GOP's religious dogma, which sternly dictates that government cannot create jobs. Only the magical free market performs that miracle. Believe it or not, though, these two are presently their party's front runners, which is why many Republicans are asking, is that all there is? Well, maybe not. His rootiness, Rudy Giuliani, now says he might jump into the race. Quote, if I think we're truly desperate. This is Jim Hightower saying, wow, that would be desperate.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You'll find the podcast there if you missed any portion of our program. Also, if you've got a smartphone, the Stitcher app is a good way to get it. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And, of course, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So today, a bipartisan group of senators, of which Bob Casey Jr. was one, along with Sherrod Brown, Chuck Schumer, Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, Olympia Snow, Republican from Maine, Debbie Stabenow from Michigan, Jeff Sessions, Republican from Alabama, and Richard Burr, Republican from North Carolina, all put forth the Currency Exchange Rate Oversight Act of 2011. Yeah, about time we decided that we're going to maybe consider doing something possibly, if the Chinese don't mind too much with their manipulation of their currency, basically screwing our exports. And again, you know, this whole currency thing, if their currency's cheaper, if they peg it down, that makes their exports cheaper. That means we buy all their cheap plastic crap, and we lose our jobs. In fact, they're saying, EPI did a study, we've lost 2.8 million American jobs in the last decade because of our trade deficit with China. In fact, 1.9 million of those have been in manufacturing. So, again, as I've said, we've just shifted our manufacturing base over to China. They've done it for us. And, of course, our investor class has done very well. Thank you very much. And you poor schmuck, the guy who lost your job working at the factory, who's now ticked off at Obama, well, it comes down to trade policies. And there are a lot of Democrats to be ticked off at. You know I'm ticked off at Clinton and a whole bunch of them. But at the end of the day, we got to do something now. And this is a start. It's going to move us in the right direction. And they claim if we force the Chinese to allow, make their currency hit equilibrium, which would be almost a 29% appreciation, we would see significant benefits to our economy. They say that we could create almost 2.25 million jobs. Increase our GDP by $285 billion, or almost 2%. We could reduce our annual trade deficit by $190 billion, which would be a step in the right direction, and our annual deficit. This deficit of $71.4 billion, or between $621 and $857 billion over 10 years. So by doing this, we're going to bring jobs back, we're going to lower our trade deficits, and also lower our deficits overall. See, this is what I've been saying we should be doing all along. This is what needs to be looked at. The fact that we're not only losing the jobs, but we're also losing all the things that go with it. The fact that, you know, now 2.8 million people probably aren't paying taxes. Now, this bill, and this is what gets me, Republicans have been on board with this for some time. In fact, last fall, the House passed a similar measure with a bipartisan, overwhelmingly bipartisan number of 348 to 79. 99 Republicans jumped on board. In 2005, when Schumer and Graham pushed through something just like this, a currency legislation like this, it passed the Senate 67 to 23. 29 Republicans jumped on board. This is something that they have passed in the process in the past. It's something they've stood for in the past, and it's something that they better look at now. And, you know, you look at the reality in all this. You know, how much of what we pick up, how much of what we buy is made in China? Now, bring some of that manufacturing home. Bring some of those jobs back home. It does a whole lot of good for our economy, and it does a whole lot of good for us. And now the president today was down in Speaker Boehner's neighborhood and Minority Leader McConnell's neighborhood. Looking at the Ohio-Kentucky border, and there is a functionally obsolete bridge there. It's the Brent Spencer Bridge, and Obama admitted, you know, picked it for purely political reasons, saying, look, this could be fixed. I've got a plan to build infrastructure. I've got a plan for repairs. You got a guy in both areas who can either kill this jobs bill or can help pass it. And, you know, good for him. About time you went into Boehner and McConnell's district and said, you know what? This kind of investment needs to be done, and your guys are holding it up. And I look here in Pennsylvania. There's an awful lot of investment that needs to be done. Fact of the matter is we've got an annual funding shortfall of about $3.5 billion when it comes to our transportation infrastructure. And the Republicans have come out with no plan. This is something that Corbett should have been spending all summer on. This is something that Corbett should have been doing instead of coming up with schemes on how to steal the election on the national level, maybe figuring out how to fix the 5,205 structurally deficient bridges that are in this state. Maybe thinking about that. Maybe thinking about, you know, what are we going to do to fill that $3.5 billion funding shortfall? And I know what the Republican plan is, privatization. We need public-private partnerships so that we give our infrastructure to for-profit corporations. And we make every bridge a toll bridge. We're going to be like New York. You want to go across the bridge, it's like $20. You want to go through the tunnel, it's $12. You want to get to the other side, you got to pay to get in and out. That's where we're heading. And now they're saying that we've collected the lowest level of a fuel tax per mile that at any time in the state's history. So there needs to be some type of refiguring there. But the reality is, all they want to talk about is divisive stuff. Let's pass English-only legislation. Let's get a voter suppression bill rammed through. Let's talk about making Pennsylvania a right to work for less state. Yeah. Let's talk about privatizing public education, privatizing the public wine and spirit shops. Yeah, let's do that. Instead of the real problems, which are our infrastructure, instead of figuring out how to fix education, they want to destroy it. You know how much money is pouring into the state to push privatization? You don't think they're spending that money because they just love Pennsylvania so much and they want to do what's in the best interest of Pennsylvania? No. They're doing it because they know that they're going to profit from it. They're going to line their pockets from your tax dollars paying for your kids' education. And if you think all of that money that you're paying in property taxes now is going to go to education in the future, you better pull your head out of the dark side of the moon, because it ain't happening. And I can't wait to see what Corbett's transportation bill looks like. I can't wait to see what his plans down the road, because they haven't done anything yet. They got their commission study. They got the study that they had required back August 1st, and they've done nothing with it yet. And tomorrow we're going to talk with State Representative Joe Markosik about this. He's the chairman of the, or former chairman, or he's the chairman of the Committee on Appropriations. He was a former transportation chairman, if I remember, last time around when the Democrats held the majority. He's the guy to talk to about this funding issue and what we should be doing. So we'll be talking to him tomorrow. But, you know, at the end of this, we got some serious problems. And if you think that putting our head in the sand and allowing the wealthy to skate away, that magically the roads are going to pave themselves, well, again, you better pop your head out of the dark side of the moon. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, Mary Botteri. The question is Scott Walker, John Doe in this FBI investigation? We're back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing light is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to psecu.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda. The Rick Smith Show.
Walker is Mubarak, Madison, Cairo, fascism track, next stop Ohio. Trying to kill labor, that's their jihad, huh? What's gonna happen when the people all rise up? Sad thing is, so we all labor. What you expect to hear? Billionaires on the papers. Mr. President.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Also, you can drop me an email, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. You know, interesting article I saw questioning whether the John Doe case going on out in Wisconsin, asking the question, is John Doe Governor Scott Walker? Here to help us answer that question is Mary Botteri. She is the director of the Real Economy Project at the Center for Media and Democracy. Mary, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me.
So is Scott Walker John Doe?
Well, we don't know yet. But I have to say this week the entire state was riveted by an investigation we sort of knew about, but we had sort of forgotten about because it started about a year ago. And then lots of things happened between now and then. We had our great winter of our discontent, and many other things here happened in Wisconsin. And all of a sudden, last week, out of the blue, the FBI raids the home of one of Scott Walker's chief lieutenants.
And what did they take? I saw that they had taken out a whole bunch of files and actually got a hard drive from a neighbor that she had sold in the garage.
Got a hard drive from a neighbor. I think they knocked on a few doors over there. And they took out a box. We don't know what was in the box, but we assume there was a computer in the box. Because lo and behold, Cindy Archer is not the first Walker aide who's had a computer seized, but the third Walker aide who's had a computer seized. So the Milwaukee County District Attorney has been quietly chugging away over there in some sort of investigation of when Scott Walker was county executive, executive, which is the chief officer for the county of Milwaukee. And at that time, there were allegations that a lot of his staffers were doing political work on county time, and that is illegal in the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, gee, I think we just went through a whole several-year process, and we've got a governor in office who put a bunch of Democrats in jail for doing exactly that here.
Well, we have a Milwaukee County DA who put a bunch of Democrats in jail for doing that.
So let me ask you this.
And he's shown a sort of bipartisan zeal for this issue because he discovered that, for instance, there's been a lot of newspaper attention to some of the lower-level staff who were literally Facebooking all day negative comments about Scott Walker's opponents in the election and positive comments about their boss. But in this type of secret John Doe investigation, what happens is that the DA brings in these lower-level staff in front of a judge and questions them and shakes them down for information about the higher-ups. And now we're seeing the higher-ups slowly quitting their jobs and quietly doing something else.
Because she was, this Cindy Archer was, Deputy Secretary of Administration?
Right. In the state of Wisconsin, Department of Administration sounds like a boring job, but it actually is the department that runs the state. Mike Hipps, who's the head of the Department of Administration, a former legislator and, you know, nice guy, glad-handing politician, is the second most powerful man in the state. Well, Cindy Archer was his top lieutenant and a top lieutenant of Scott Walker's. People who work in the Capitol say she's one of the few persons that could just walk right into the governor's office without having to knock, and that she did that all the time. And we found a series of Archer emails in some of our Freedom of Information Act requests that we did over the course of the winter that indicate that she played a totally central role in preparing for the collective bargaining bill and in preparing other aspects of the Walker agenda.
So it sounds like she's got more power than the Koch brother had.
That may be true. And so, you know, it's funny you mentioned the Koch brothers because that's one of the most famous incidents from the winter where Scott Walker took a call who he thought was from Koch brother billionaire David Koch, and he regaled him with this great story saying, I met with my cabinet the other night and we discussed everything that was going to happen, and we see now from the emails that they were actually doing contingency planning right before the bill was introduced. He had a late night cabinet meeting at the governor's mansion, a private sort of secret meeting where they were discussing all the contingency plans of what if the state exploded when he dropped the bomb, what if, you know, people started barricading the doors and all these kinds of things. And it's a famous meeting because he said, I held up a picture of Ronald Reagan and said, when he fired the PATCO workers, that was the beginning of the end for communism. And it was a clink in the wall. And he sort of likened himself to Ronald Reagan. But we found out now from these emails that the one person who wasn't a cabinet secretary who was in the room with him at the time was Cynthia Archer. So right now the governor's playing dumb. He's like, Cindy Archer who? And he says, I don't know anything about this investigation. I only know what I read in the papers, but she's been a very central player in this administration.
Does he play dumb? That was really kind of wrong. But, you know, here's the thing. And in looking at this, and you brought up an interesting point. She was central in this, in the whole budget, in the budget repair bill, in the whole theft of collective bargaining, and a lot of the nasty stuff that's gone on there. Let's say that they've done all of the things that, the horrible things that we could imagine, and they all get locked up in jail. It's still not going to change any of that stuff. And that's what bothers me.
Well, the question is, when you have this type of secret investigation, and let me just say that I personally am not a fan of this type of investigation because they apply such strict gag rules to everyone involved. You know, you don't actually know who the target is.
Right.
But it's clear that she was one of his top lieutenants when he worked in Milwaukee County. Another top lieutenant, Tom Nardelli, who is his chief of staff, has also recently stepped down from his state job. So, you know, people are stepping down from their jobs and quietly slinking off into the sunset. We wonder if there are going to be arrests. We wonder if this investigation is really going to touch the governor.
Yeah, I can't wait to see how this works out. But, you know, why call in the FBI? I mean, isn't this a state issue? Isn't this something that the state could be taking care of? Or does this district attorney think that he would have some problems dealing with the Walker administration, which is why they would bring in the FBI?
Well, you got to believe that these political apparatchiks really know how to delete email and double delete email and triple delete email. So when you're involved in this type of investigation, you really need forensic computer people to reconstruct what can be reconstructed off of their hard drives. In the state of Wisconsin, there's only two people who do that. It's the Republican Attorney General's office or the FBI. And so my guess is they brought in the FBI in order to avoid the Republican Attorney General, or alternatively, the Republican Attorney General declined to help because it involved a Republican governor.
So at this point, you know, nobody knows anything. It's just a lot of speculation.
It's a lot of speculation, but we already had one felony conviction related to Scott Walker's campaign practices, or I should say the campaign practices while he was running for governor. We had a conviction of a Wisconsin railroad executive who started using his employees to funnel money to the Walker campaign and funneled at least $60,000 to $100,000 in illegal contributions. So he pled guilty in April, in the middle of all this brouhaha in Wisconsin. It wasn't covered very well, but he pled guilty. He's now on probation, and we're waiting for other chips to fall.
Yeah, you look at this, and all these people funneling money into these campaigns, it's amazing to me that they think they're going to get away with it.
Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, sometimes some of this stuff is hard to track. I mean, employers bundle employees, you know, the employers have fundraisers and employees show up. So maybe it has to do with that. Maybe it's tracking other employers who are bundling money. Maybe the campaign had knowledge of this. Maybe not. We actually just don't know. And it's important to mention that the governor has not only denied all knowledge, but Cynthia Archer has denied all knowledge. But behind the scenes, people are saying that a lot of people in this town are fully lawyered up, everybody is waiting on pins and needles for the next domino to fall.
Yeah, I look at Wisconsin, and maybe Walker has done a service to the state on one level, brought a whole bunch of people in to spend money in Madison, has got jobs for lawyers. Maybe he's somewhat good for the economy.
That's true. The lawyers seem to be doing well these days, although there was another story in today's paper that his official website for folks needing a job in Wisconsin, that one in four of the jobs is out of state. So we're not doing that well here in Wisconsin, and we had a 14% drop in our median income. So maybe some of our politicians should be focusing on the real economy and the real issues that matter around here.
Yeah, that's a good idea. But please keep us up to date on how this moves down the road. I would love nothing more than to see a whole bunch of people doing the perp walk.
We will call you first, Rick.
Thank you so much, Mary. Mary Bateri, director of the Real Economy Project, Center for Media and Democracy. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not going to break tonight, and we're not going to bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town.
that united we bargain, divided we mend.
Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefits Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times, but without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our human services campaign.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. USA Today had an interesting story asking how the recession has changed you. How's your life changed? How are things, you know, how do you view things? Has the last couple of years changed your outlook, changed the, changed your life in any way? They're saying that this dismal economy is having some profound effects on the American way of life. In fact, this woman who did this this study, she came out, her name's Cheryl Russell, former editor of the American Demographics, and now editorial director of the New Strategist Publications. She said it's going to have a long-term impact, and to say it's going to end is optimistic. She says, I'm more pessimistic that this is the new normal. And what they looked at, using Census Bureau numbers, this is pretty detailed stuff here, that people are marrying later, that you're seeing a larger number of first marriages happening when people are later or older in life. People are having fewer children, obviously, because they're marrying later. Fewer divorces, which I guess, not a bad thing, but unless you're miserable, which may be why you're seeing some bizarre stuff going on. More people are living in the same house, so you're seeing an increase of the number of people living together, and that might be not a bad thing, that families, start bringing grandma and grandpa in or whatever. And the fact that nobody's home. There are a lot of vacant houses. There are a lot of foreclosures, a lot of this stuff going on. And then they're saying, some bad things too. We're not carpooling as much because people are driving solo, and we're seeing more folks sending their kids to public school than to private school. because the private school enrollment has gone down considerably. So, you know, what are some of the things that may have changed? And, you know, I sat and I thought about it today a little bit, and, you know, I guess I take less vacation now. I take a lot less vacation. I take less days off. I take, you know, this summer we did fewer family outings, spent more time at home. We did a lot less eating out. You know, less new clothes. I mean, when the kids need school clothes, you got to do that. But I know myself, I think I've got the exact same wardrobe I had last year, which isn't much different from the year before, which is mostly just jeans and T-shirts.
You cut back in, what's the word? Club memberships? Is that the right word?
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about, I think gym membership is the right word.
No, I still got my gym membership.
Oh, you did? You just don't use it.
I haven't.
Okay.
No.
I just want to clarify that. Trying to help you out here, Rick.
How did that help?
I thought you forgot that.
No, I remember it.
Me bad. I remember. My mistake.
I remember it every day.
Okay.
Where I go, you know, I got all this work to do, and I've got no time to do it.
Okay.
You know, we're out here doing all the things that have to be done. To put the program together, to fund it, to, you know, do all the things that are going on. It takes a lot of time. These are 14-hour, 15-hour days.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of work.
Well, you know, maybe an idea would be to maybe move an extra cycle in here. That would save you a lot of time. Just a suggestion.
Or maybe I could take on somebody, another partner, maybe somebody who, you know, lighten the load a little bit.
Okay, that's a good idea.
That's a good idea. Maybe if there are any applicants out there, let me know. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Also, I think I last year we gave a little bit less in our charitable contributions. And we kept some things together at home with, you know, bubble gum and barbed wire. You know, we were fixing things instead of replacing them. That's kind of how we've changed things a little bit. You know, again, you know, it comes down to how does life change when money's tighter? How do things change when, you know, the economy's uncertain? And there's an awful lot of talk about this. I mean, you cannot turn on right-wing radio in this country and not think the sky is falling on your head. You cannot turn on talk radio without thinking the end of the world is near. I keep saying, look, we've got opportunities. There are tons of opportunities. We just have to have the political will to do them. And sadly, all I keep hearing from the radical right is that, well, we can't do things. We don't have the money. We can't invest in infrastructure. We can't help the people who were harmed in the flood. We're gonna shut the government down because we can't agree that we need to help people in this time of need. I keep hearing, oh, gee, you know, we just can't invest. Education's too expensive. Oh, you know, we need health care too much. You know, we could get this economy going again with some very smart, targeted investments. And the president's plan is moving in that direction. There are bridges, 5,200 of them right here in the state of Pennsylvania. You want to put people back to work? 5,200 bridges right now need attention today, this minute. That's not tomorrow, that's not a week, that's not a year, that's right now, today, this very second, that we don't have the resources to work on. All I keep hearing, though, from the radical right and their mouthpiece minions is that, oh, we're broke. Oh, we can't tax the rich people. Oh, can't do that. We're going to have to offset it with cuts from those poor people because they're lazy. I mean, it's mind-boggling. And I keep hearing this ridiculous, well, we can't have any regulation. You know, heaven forbid that we oversee things as it goes, oh, job-killing regulations. Oh, any regulation's going to kill jobs, right? That's what they keep saying, right? You're going to kill them. Well, the people who are ProPublica, they went around and they did a little bit of investigating. They asked some experts to say, you know, hey, what do you think of this? And most of the people said, look, there's been very little in the way of scholarship, very little in the way of academic studies. But, you know, the reality is there's some evidence that, you know, it does destroy some jobs. But it creates others. So basically it's a zero-sum game. You're just shifting a little bit. Even the people over at the Mercatus Institute, which I found really kind of funny, that the people at the Mercatus, the Koch brother funded Mercatus Center over at George Mason University, said, you know, yeah, well, you know, it is what it is. But, you know, what we need to be talking about is, you know, if it's going to make us any, if it's going to be good for the economy. Because, you know, you can't get caught in a lie. So what they did is, you say, well, you know, we just want to, we want to make sure that, you know, it creates jobs. Now, most people agree, look, it's a shift. It is what it is. If you go in and you make, if you do away with a product, and they talked about lead and gasoline. Yeah, you're gonna cause jobs to go away. But the product is still, there's gasoline still gonna be there. You're still gonna have people working in that. So it's not end of the game. Which is what you hear Republicans talking about. If we regulate things, that'll just destroy things. What about the lives of people that you're going to save? What about the environment that you're not going to have to clean up? Or quarantine off so that we don't go near it? What about those things? What about the loss of the land? Now, I've been listening to all of these
Range Resources, my drilling company. And they're wonderful people. They're the people you kind of drive into your house and have a beer with. I keep hearing all these ads, and it's constant. It's mind-numbing, and it's always, oh, they're wonderful. They're like us. You know, they care about the law. They're wonderful. The reality is all they want is what's under the ground. They don't care how they get it. They just don't want to get fined. They don't want to get into trouble, and I agree with that. But what's going to happen down the road?
Well, one thing that really bothers me, here's the thing. When you have government and industry tied at the hip, especially an administration like this, there's a sense within these corporate entities that, you know, maybe they can stretch the law a little bit. They can drag their feet in certain regulations. There's no doubt in my mind that when it comes to giving jobs to Pennsylvanians, you know, these companies, and I understand it from their perspective, it's cheaper for them not to hire Pennsylvanians. They would prefer to hire people who have been working for them. Well, you know what? This is our state. And I think that's the governor and the Republicans are missing something. This is our state. And we should be getting maximum benefit. And how do you get maximum benefit? You not only tax the Marcellus Shale project, but you also give as many jobs as possible to Pennsylvania. And I think there's ever-increasing evidence that they're just dragging their feet on that issue.
Yeah, so we keep hearing this whole thing, the job-killing regulations, and the reality is it's not. But, you know, you can't let go of a good frame. And any rational person will come to that conclusion. Yeah, it may cost a job or two, but it's going to be made up when you look at the person who's overseeing it, who's doing the regulating. And you know what? Maybe regulations aren't the evil part in this. And I was listening to one of some program here today, just for a couple of minutes driving through. A guy was complaining that the township was overseeing, wanted to look at his septic tank or something. And I'm going, you know, as someone who has neighbors who have septic tanks, I'd kind of like to know that their stuff isn't leaking into my well. Kind of like to know that it's not ruining the water table that my well goes into. Kind of, you know, just a thought. I don't want to be drinking sewage. And, you know, it was this venom. I don't want them on my property. And I'm going, but, you know, I want them to make sure that you're not screwing up mine. And it's this thought that people go, well, I have rights. So do I. And your right to do whatever the hell you want to do is stopped the second it infringes on my right. You have to do whatever you want until it infringes on me. You can swing your fists around until it hits me in the nose. You can jump up and down until you land on my foot. Then we got problems. And it's this, you know, and you listen to the radical right, and I can only take that stuff for minutes at a time. I don't know how you do it. I can't listen to the masturbatory event more than 2 or 3 minutes where, oh, you're a wonderful American. Destroy the government. You're a wonderful American. I can only take that for minutes at a time. And this whole ridiculous... it's just amazing to me.
Well, I mean, in answer to your comment, I watch it. I listen to these shows, and they tend to be conservative because I want to get to some degree, and I understand it's basically a conservative listening audience, but occasionally you have people that actually take the opposite view or they take the moderate view. And I want to get a feel of what the public's thinking. That's why I do it.
God bless you. Somebody's got to do it. Might as well be you. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Thousands of Tyson poultry workers are celebrating a victory for justice on the job in a $32 million legal settlement. More than 17,000 workers at 41 Tyson plants in 12 states will finally get paid for work they did. The legal battle to win this settlement took 12 years. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union filed lawsuits to collect wages for workers who were not paid for the time spent taking gear on and off. The lawsuit settlement means about $1,000 for each worker, including current and former Tyson poultry workers. UFCW President Joe Hansen says every American deserves to be paid for the work they do. This case illustrates one of the benefits of workers having a union voice on the job. The unionization of child care workers is making headlines in two states this week. Jesse Russell reports.
In Connecticut, Governor Dan Malloy has signed two executive orders that will make it possible for family child care providers and personal care attendants to organize. Malloy issued a statement restating his belief in the rights of workers to organize and collectively bargain. In Minnesota, the Republican-controlled legislature is planning to hold hearings regarding efforts of in-home child care workers to organize. While Democratic Governor Mark Dayton has called the hearing a waste of the taxpayers' money, the Republicans said the hearings are necessary to address concerns raised by parents. Dayton could sign an executive order similar to the one signed by Malloy in Connecticut, but he's made it clear he has no intention of doing so. Instead, Dayton wants the 11,000 workers to cast a new vote expressing their desire to organize or not.
Wisconsin Republican Congressman Paul Ryan, appearing on a right-wing radio talk show this week, supported Texas Governor Rick Perry's monstrous lie that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. When asked if Social Security is a Ponzi scheme, Ryan responded, "That is how those schemes work." We already know Ryan wants to end Medicare as we know it and replace it with vouchers to buy private insurance. Now he's venturing out onto even thinner ice by comparing Social Security to a Ponzi scheme. Whatever his opinion about Social Security, it's clear it is not a Ponzi scheme. The Securities and Exchange Commission definition of a Ponzi scheme is a, quote, investment fraud that involves the payment of purported returns to existing investors from funds contributed by new investors. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We don't get it! Shut them down! We don't get it! Shut them down! We don't get it! Shut them down! We don't get it! Shut them down!
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast. If you got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. You can take your program on the go. So today, nearly 23,000 registered nurses were on a one-day strike at 34 Northern and Central California hospitals. Here to talk a little bit about what's going on there, Deborah Berger. She is the president of the 85,000-member California Nurses Association. Deborah, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, my pleasure.
So what's going on today? What happened today?
Well, today was truly historic. It was the largest RN strike in the country, and we rocked everywhere from Fresno all the way up to Santa Rosa and Clear Lake, and we were all out on strike for patient safety and to preserve health care benefits and retiree benefits for all workers.
So now that you've answered all of my questions in one sentence, let's talk about some of the requests that they that are on the table, some of the 200 demands that I guess this Sutter Corporation wants to impose on you guys.
Well, it's really pretty impressive. It's almost like taking a 50-year-old contract and just tearing it up. That's essentially what they're doing.
Kind of like
they want to end the ability of charge nurses, the ones that make clinical assessments, to effectively advocate for our patients, meaning that they could just be removed by nurse managers for protecting patients and speaking up on their behalf. They want to bar the voice of the bedside nurse in selecting the computer acuity systems that are used to help determine staffing levels that nurses know patients need and can be properly assessed and staffing determined by those systems, so they don't want nurses' input on those. They want to be able to discipline nurses when the hospital fails to meet arbitrary patient satisfaction goals. You know, patients don't get their meal tray on time, and somehow they want to blame the nurse for that, even though they're short-staffed. They want to eliminate paid sick time for RNs, so it would force nurses to come to work sick and expose countless patients who are already immunocompromised, put them at risk. And then they want to have nurses accept thousands of dollars in out-of-pocket health care costs for RNs and their families. And it would essentially make health care in those systems inaccessible to the RNs and their families that work in those facilities.
That's amazing
and,
to me.
I mean, I could go on and on and on, and I know I sound like I am.
No, I understand
if
this.
If you go to the calnurses.org website, you can see all of the 200 proposals that are out there, and it's just outrageous considering that they made $9.1 billion over the last 2 years.
Wow. That's obscene.
It is.
And we wonder why our costs are so high.
What they're doing is taking advantage of this right-wing agenda in this country and pitting worker against worker by saying, wait a minute, you guys have it, nobody else has it, why should you guys keep it? And, you know, we've got a Main Street contract for the American people that says, wait a minute, we shouldn't be fighting this between each other, and you know, just because somebody else has it, we should take it away from everyone. Everyone should have good health care. Everyone should have retiree benefits so that they can retire in dignity. Everybody should have access to a real vacation, real sick time, real holiday pay. So we think that this is just really greedy hospital corporations taking advantage of this really mean-spirited agenda by the Tea Party and many other groups out there that are really trying to undermine workers' rights.
Yeah, you brought up the 50-year contract. Takes me back to the Verizon strike that just happened. In places where workers don't have the ability to collectively bargain, to go on strike, as you have done and the folks at Verizon have done, all of those 200 things that are on your list and the 100 things that were on their list are just imposed. There's no talking about it. There's no negotiating over it. It's just how it is. And I've often said that the American worker suffers from a form of Stockholm syndrome because they're constantly beaten. They don't have the ability to do as you guys have done today.
Well, and what's interesting is that in many of our facilities, the workers that wanted to come out and support the nurses and wanted to come out and support NUHW couldn't do it because their even though their managers weren't overtly threatening, they were implying that they could lose their job if they honored the picket line. So it was pretty interesting to see what was going on here.
I got to tell you, you know, to me, I would think as a hospital administrator, as someone who ran a hospital, you want to have your most hands-on people having the most input. I mean, when my grandmother was in the hospital, and she's been in a couple of times because she's in her 80s, the person that I don't really usually turn to the doctor, I ask the nurses because they tend to have a much better grasp on how to explain it than the doctors do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the reality is that, you know, when a doctor comes in and talks to a patient, they kind of talk at them, and then they ask the nurse for the translation and what does that really mean, and, you know, and they're taking care of people in the most vulnerable. And as one of our presidents in the California Nurses Association said, if the nurses are on the outside, there's something wrong on the inside.
That's
and Deanne was absolutely right. All over California, nurses were out on the picket line. They would have much rather been inside providing care, but they felt that their community and their coworkers were under attack and couldn't cooperate with management in order to you know, still provide care. And it's interesting, Kaiser sent 17,000 nurses at least five letters at 44 cents apiece, telling them in one point they were good girls, in one letter they were bad girls, and, oh, we thought we had a deal with you, we thought we had you bought off, so why are you honoring somebody else's picket line? And it was very insulting to the nurses to get those letters because they know the law, they know their rights, and they felt that Kaiser administration was trying to mislead everyone.
They didn't actually call them good girls and bad girls, did they?
Well, if you read the letter, it was, you know, we're very disappointed that you're taking this step. We thought we had a deal with you. We gave you a great contract. You even said it was a great contract, and now you're going out in sympathy strike with your coworkers. You have a contract, and you need to abide by that, and we're really trying to tell nurses that they didn't know how to interpret the law is what
they're in a very condescending kind of way.
Yeah, it was very patronizing.
Amazing stuff. And, you know, I look at this, and what kind of response did you get from the community? Because I have to imagine,
God,
nurses...
We had donations. It was really interesting. We had donations of food. We had one business that brought us tons of cupcakes, you know, individually wrapped and everything. We had, as people were going by, they were honking their horns. And, in fact, at one point, we could overhear one of the administrators saying, well, I wonder how much community support they're getting. And we could hear the honking, you know, from one street to another. So we know, and we know they know what kind of support we got. So it was really heartwarming to have people come to the picket line and bring us, you know, food and water and support. Even one of the patients that was in the hospital today was in the hospital before we went out on strike, and he came out in between treatments to show support for the nurse that was taking care of him yesterday.
Wow, that's fantastic.
It was fantastic.
Yeah, you know, I look at this, and again, you know, it's about having a voice, but two, it's about having that respect. So from this mm-hmm. point forward, now that you've had this showing, where do you suspect things are going to go as we move down the road?
Well, we're concerned about Sutter because they have consistently refused to negotiate in a realistic manner. They've refused to acknowledge that there is no real reason for them to cut benefits. There's no real reason for them to get rid of our pension plans, which aren't multi-million-dollar pension plans. This is so that you'll have maybe $1,000 or $2,000 a month to live on in addition to Social Security. So these aren't like the CEO pensions that, you know, the CEOs are getting.
Right.
And so we hope that as a result of the community outpouring of support, Sutter will see that they're overreaching in their demands and pull back.
Well, that is the hope, because at the end of the day, this should be done at the bargaining table, and they should, and I understand these things are to get those folks to come to the bargaining table and actually be in a serious way.
Mm-hmm. We thought that the threat of the strike would be something to bring them to the table, but in Santa Rosa, what happened at Sutter in Santa Rosa at the bargaining table, one of the nurses was reading why she was going out and why she felt that Sutter was essentially abandoning the community, and the Sutter bargaining team on the Sutter side, on the corporation side, got up and left in the middle of her talking to them and left the room.
Wow.
So even with the threat of the impending strike, they got up and left. It was outrageous.
It says an awful lot about what they think of their patients and the people that work for them.
Yeah.
It says an awful lot. But I hope you guys get nothing but the best. I watched some of the strike today online.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like an amazing event. I'm hoping that this does what we're supposed to do and get them back to negotiating, and you guys get the contract I think you deserve.
Okay, and you can always, anybody can always check our website and look for the photos. We're also on YouTube. We have a YouTube videos of all of the photos and everything that went on. So if anybody wants to see what's happening with the nurses' strikes and our negotiations, they can check it out there.
And we will link that all to our website at thericksmithshow.com. Deborah Berger, it's great talking with you. I hope you'll come back and give us an update.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. We're going to take a quick break right back after this with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Covering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Now, let's turn the Hubble telescope to the faraway galaxy where Rick, Nit, Michelle, and Goofy are contending for the Republican presidential nomination. In the GOP's recent debate at the Reagan Library, its seekers of the presidency collectively caused people to gasp and say to themselves, "Gosh, I miss Ronald Reagan's intellect." Especially stupid was the outbreak during the debate of a schoolboy spat between Rick Perry and Mitt Romney over the serious issue of job creation. Let's replay the moment. Romney had boasted of his performance as a job creator during his governorship in Massachusetts, leading to this retort by Perry. "Michael Dukakis created jobs 3 times faster than you did, Mitt." To which Romney shot back, "Well, as a matter of fact, George Bush and his predecessor created jobs at a faster rate than you did, Governor." Mustering all of his wits, Perry parried with this fib, "That's not correct." And Romney struck the last blow by declaring definitively, "Yes, that is correct." Aside from their juvenile inanity, it's revealing to hear the two Republicans brag about having created jobs. "Look at what we've done over the last decade," Perry exclaimed at another point in the debate. "We created 1 million jobs in the state of Texas." We? That's Republican heresy. Indeed, out on the campaign trail, both Rick and Mitt are piously faithful to the GOP's religious dogma, which sternly dictates that government cannot create jobs. Only the magical free market performs that miracle. Believe it or not, though, these two are presently their party's front runners, which is why many Republicans are asking, is that all there is? Well, maybe not. His rootiness, Rudy Giuliani, now says he might jump into the race, quote, "if I think we're truly desperate." This is Jim Hightower saying, wow, that would be desperate.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
more proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I'm in the process of taking a look at trying to win a day on the road with Mitt Romney. I saw the little Google ad, and I couldn't help but click on it. So I'm trying to figure out if there's a way I can win a trip, a day on the road with Mitzi, talking to voters across the country. Because voters like you decide the outcome of this election, so Mitt wants to hear from you. So fill out and give him some money, and maybe you'll be able to, you know, to win. I always thought contests you didn't have to put money in. It says no purchase necessary, but you know, I'm not seeing a way of doing that. Because you know, Mitt's like you and me. Mitt's part of the middle class. He's right there. He's with us. Mitt's one of our guys. You know,
the 80 to 90% of us.
Yeah, the 80 to 90% of us. You know, we're buds. Me and Mitt. All of us and Mitzi, you know, we eat at the same, you know, greasy spoons. You know, we obviously wear the same kind of clothes. You know, I would guess, and just a guess, the suit that he wore tonight at the debate, the value of that suit alone is probably worth my entire wardrobe twice. Just a guess, just don't, you know, and maybe somebody out there can prove me wrong, but I'm thinking that suit alone, my entire wardrobe.
Well, truth in advertising, you don't really have that many suits, correct?
I have two. I have a funeral suit and a gray pimp suit.
Gray pimp suit. Yeah. Okay.
It's what it looks like. I got a purple shirt under a gray suit. Kind of what it looked like.
Okay.
It is what it is. And I have my funeral suit. And, my birthday suit, but I didn't pay for that. That came with me.
There's only one problem with Mr. Romney. We don't quite know, Rick, how many homes the man has. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but the good thing about him is he did expand the one he had, you know, quadrupled the size of it. That $12 million beachfront. Now, you know, he's going to put a whole bunch of money in. Going to help. Guy who's one of us. You know, the guy who's one of us, he's not worth $250,000 a year or $500,000. You know, he's worth $250 million.
Wow.
That puts him well in that top, you know, 2.5%.
So I guess he moved out of his son's house there in Massachusetts, right?
He moved out of the basement, yeah.
There you go.
Had to give up the basement. You know, the dog needed a room. So
he's moving on up.
And good for him. I heard in the debate, Mitzi won the one focus group because of his views on health care. So maybe there are some sane people in the Republican Party after all. I don't know. But I've heard Huntsman is actually coming up the rear. And, you know, that should make Santorum happy. So there you go. Did you see this thing about Tony Bennett? Evidently, he was on Howard Stern's show and said something that really ticked off some of the 9/11 people. He said, quote, "Who are the terrorists? Are we the terrorists or are they the terrorists? Two wrongs don't make a right. They flew planes in, but we caused it. We were bombing them and they told us to stop." Well, evidently, he's gotten a whole slew of trouble. So of course he went on his Facebook page and, you know, made an apology saying, "Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset anyone, blah, blah, blah." But, the reality is, and you look at what Ron Paul said, and it's what I've been saying for the longest time. Look, the reason they did it, and Bin Laden was quite clear, was the fact that we were building, an Air Force base on their holy land, the fact that our unfettered, support of Israel and that oil wasn't $200 a barrel. No other reason. That was it. And to say anything else other than that, you know, it's kind of rewriting history a little bit. But he got himself into a little twist, which, you know, kind of dumb thing to say, even if it is the reality. But kind of a dumb thing to say, don't you think?
Yeah, I don't know.
For an 85-year-old singer?
I don't know why I got into it.
And to be honest, at 85 years old, if it's me, I'm telling you to go take a flying leap at a rolling donut. I don't care what you think. I'm 85.
He's 85.
He's 85.
Wow.
I'm like, I'm not going to live much longer. What do I care about you?
But can he still sing? He always had a good voice.
I don't know. Not a big Tony Bennett fan.
Oh, okay.
I am now, though. You know. I can't tell you one song he sings.
Does that mean you're going out and buying all his albums?
I am
going to
buy the albums.
There you go.
Yeah.
So, actually, he was smart. He got, you know, people like you, who, you know, people on the left who, you know, it encouraged them to look into his music, and it's going to be a possible huge upsurge in people buying his albums. So, you know, maybe the man's smarter than we give him credit for.
Well, maybe I won't. Now that you put it that way, maybe I won't. maybe it was a mistake. Sorry I brought it up. Maybe I will buy this. A new book going to be coming out, Total Recall, my unbelievably true life story. Guess who's going to be writing that? That's right, the Governator. Arnold is going to be penning a book. It should be right around October of 2012, I guess, is going to be when the memoir will be published. I wonder if he'll talk about the child that he fathered, he squired while...
Oh, my.
And I wonder if he'll want to try and totally recall that. I don't know. But, you know, hey, he needs a job, I guess. He needs a couple of bucks. So there you go. Because he was doing that government work. And everybody knows government work doesn't pay. I always wondered why he did that. Why would you become governor? Why would you put up with all the headaches? Why would you go through all of that when you're making hundreds of millions of dollars a year, pinching every actress on the behind, doing all the things he knew he was doing? I mean, that's the life, man.
Well, I guess it was the next step. I mean, he was this international weight, bodybuilding star. He went from that to the movies. And he kind of morphed into politics. I mean, he certainly, the ultimate in doing that, going from being a movie star to politics, was Ronald Reagan. So he's certainly not the first one to do that.
There's some times where I say, you know, maybe we should just float California off. Because, you know, the sad thing is, you know, had he been born here, maybe he'd be up on the stage with Snow White and the Eight Dwarfs. Because evidently there were eight dwarfs tonight. They brought somebody else in, so that ought to be interesting. Also, some Chinese ruffled feathers. We had talked about it the other night that the United States was going to be selling some military goods to the Taiwanese. The Chinese not happy. Evidently, we were going to sell some F-16 fighters. Beijing not happy. And again, you know, I see this thing with the. With the bipartisan bill to go after the currency manipulation, arming the Taiwanese, are we taking a little bit tougher stance on China? I hope so.
I guess my question is, what right-thinking congressman wouldn't back that bill? Unless there's corporations that have come to them and say, you know what, if you take off the Japanese, the Chinese, it'll make it harder for us to do business in China.
Yeah, I understand. Business, I don't think, is for it. You know, I was watching this hearing the other day, and all of the business people who do business both here and in China, they're claiming that the currency, it's a wash. It's not affecting the businesses because most of the trade is happening inside the business model.
Intra.
Yeah, I mean, it's happening within the business model. GE is shipping from GE China to GE America. So it's not really trade as we see it. And they're saying basically it's a wash. Who it's harming is the American worker. It's not harming the corporations because they're moving over anyone. The companies that are willing to move, they're doing just fine. Doesn't matter to them. The companies that are trying to stay here, they're the ones who are being harmed by it. So it depends on which side of this you're on. If you're the big corporations who already have operations there, you're fine. You don't care about the currency manipulation. If you're a manufacturer who's trying to be an American manufacturer, that currency manipulation is screwing you to no end. It is putting you at a major competitive disadvantage. And that's where this whole thing is going to play out. It'll be interesting to see where the Tea Party people come down on this, because they did run on this idea that we need trade and we need fair trade and all that. But it'll be interesting because they are bought and paid for by the big corporate special interest. So it'll be really, really kind of interesting in the next couple of months. So we're going to take a quick break. Right back with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
When you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Fillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. The big debate tonight, find out, what's going to go on, where they're going. Another one? Haven't we had enough? Anyway, here to tell us what's going on in Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Yeah, we want more.
To be honest, I think I've had enough. I've had enough of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and the whole sideshow. It's nothing new. It's all going to be the same stuff.
It may be new tonight.
Yeah.
Yes. Well. We may get all kinds of things tonight. I mean, one thing we might get tonight is we might get an attack on Ben Bernanke, that he is, in fact, a traitor because he did try to stimulate the economy yesterday.
Yeah. How dare he screw up their plans?
May do that. We may hear some questioning of Rick Perry about the fact that Texas's unemployment numbers are on the rise, and if he chooses to run on his employment record, then maybe he has to run on his unemployment record too.
And I'm sure he's going to have to run on abstinence only as well. Third highest teen pregnancy rate in the country, because after all, abstinence works. We just haven't been applying it right.
There you go.
I love that.
So I mean, there are a lot of fun things that can come up tonight. Including, of course, government funding, Social Security. They are in Florida, after all.
Yeah. Speaking of government funding,
yes.
It appears to me as, we're looking down the barrel of another government shutdown.
We're looking down the barrel. I don't know if anybody's going to actually pull the trigger on us. I'm not saying that they wouldn't, because the four dozen House conservatives who walked out might. But what happened yesterday was this must-pass stopgap funding bill didn't.
Right.
Because four dozen conservatives defied Speaker Boehner and said, well, no, we're not going to do what you say.
Sounds like mutiny.
Yeah, even though you say you are going to strip us of our committee assignments, we don't care. So today, and of course Democrats voted against it because the funding for FEMA was offset by cuts.
Right.
So Democrats said, no, we're not voting for it, apart from about six Democrats. But for Democrats, that's very unanimous.
Good. Yeah, I mean, you got most of the cats into the box.
Most of the cats. I'm looking at a cat right now, and I'm thinking, that's hard. That's hard. So they're trying again today. They're going to see if they can get they can corral those Republicans, and they're going to see if they can do something to tweak this bill to bring the Democrats online. But the Democrats are saying the only way we'll come on board is if you do not offset the FEMA funding at all.
Right. And at this point, that's the smart thing to do, in my opinion. Aren't you kind of undermining some of what's going on with this big super secret super committee? I mean, on some level?
In a way, I mean, that argument could be made.
I mean, because, look, the folks here in Pennsylvania, the folks who had the water sweep most of their possessions away, they need help now, not down the road when you're done bickering.
Well, that's the argument that's being made, that they need the help now.
And the other question then becomes,
yes.
If by tomorrow night this doesn't get done for some odd reason, Do they go home next week and let it go to, let it close?
Well, strong arguments are being made that they shouldn't, and that they will, if necessary, work through the weekend. The House hopes to vote tonight, and Harry Reid over on the Senate side is saying, well, they probably won't vote tonight, they'll vote tomorrow. Mitch McConnell, his opposition, is saying, no, we'll vote tonight. Reid is saying, well, we probably won't get the bill till way after midnight. And then you see, the bill they're going to get from the House isn't the bill that they want. The Senate's already passed the bill.
Right.
Which is completely different from the House bill.
Well, it looks like they may be working through the weekend.
They could be working through the weekend.
And through part of next week as well.
Which
I'm not against.
They're not going to be happy about.
Good. I'm not happy for them. I guess something interesting popped up. Lloyd's of London suing Saudi Arabia?
Fascinating.
How's this work?
Fascinating. Yes, Lloyd's of London is seeking $215 million in damages from Saudi Arabia to recover claims that it's paid 9/11 victims and their families. And the suit charges that the Saudi government funded al-Qaeda through its banks and charities. And the complaint was filed in U.S. court. And it states that without official Saudi sponsorship, al-Qaeda would not have possessed the capacity to conceive, plan, and execute the September the 11th attacks. So in other words, the Twin Towers will still be standing along with nearly 3,000 Americans. And Investors Business Daily, which is the article that I have about this, says that it's very impressed by the documentation. It's a 156-page complaint by a major Washington law firm. And it's apparently much more detailed than the lawsuit brought on behalf of 9/11 families, which a federal judge did dismiss for lack of evidence. It points to new intelligence, including recently leaked diplomatic cables. Mm-hmm. And there are some very interesting findings. Senior Saudi officials and Saudi royal family members either served as executives of suspect charities or sat on their boards while the charities were used to launder money to al-Qaeda, and they knew of the activities. The Saudi charities themselves often provided not only money, but employment cover, ID badges, and logistical support to al-Qaeda operatives. And I mean, between 98 and 2000, the Saudi Joint Relief Committee allegedly diverted more than $74 million to al-Qaeda members and loyalists affiliated with its bureaus. At that time, the SJRC was under the control of Saudi Prince Nayef, who after 9/11 denied that Saudis were among the hijackers and hinted that Jews carried out the attacks.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and it goes on and on and on and on.
This might be, I'm rooting for this. This might be an avenue for us to go get some of our money back as well.
Yeah, it's really very, very interesting. There's a great deal here.
I can't wait to follow this because, you know, I remember when the 9/11 victims' families went and tried to do this. I was kind of hopeful then, even though I knew the courts would probably do as they did. But this sounds like it might have a shot of at least getting past the first hurdle, I guess.
Getting past the first hurdle. This one, there's more material. Leaked diplomatic cables. What are we talking about? We're talking about WikiLeaks.
Yep.
About WikiLeaks.
I'm all in favor of them. I wish we had more. Bad stock market day today. She's talking about money.
Very bad stock market today. Asia started off badly, then Europe followed, and then Wall Street took one look at it and said, we're going to be lemmings and we're going straight off the cliff.
Yeah.
Basically, there was weak data for the Eurozone, a grim assessment from the Federal Reserve for the U.S., and it all looks pretty bad, and everybody decided, you know something, today's the day. We're just going down today, and things went down somewhere between 3% and 4%, and it was not good. Nobody thinks it's going to get very much better. The Fed pointed to a lot of long-term problems in the American economy, including a depressed housing market and high unemployment. They don't think that things are going to improve anytime soon. Moody's has just downgraded three big American banks, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup, saying government support's become less likely in the event of financial trouble. And there are a lot of problems in Europe, and there's a potential problem in China. So overall, things are just not good.
Yeah, not good. And the housing thing, nobody seems to be even paying any attention to. It's just kind of like, it's like out there. It's like the gorilla in the room that nobody's, you know, paying attention to, or the, you know, the turd in the punch bowl.
No, the housing thing is key, and obviously the Fed is paying a good bit of attention to it. It's seeing it as key.
But it doesn't appear as though anything's being done.
No, I'm not sure they know what to do.
Yeah, well, doesn't surprise me. Lastly, the big debate tonight, how many of these are we going to have?
A lot. I don't know the number,
I'm already tired of it.
I know, this is the thing, and this is just for the primary, you know. This is to pick the guy who's going to go up against Obama. Then, of course, they have to agree on the number of debates between the candidate who's going to go against Obama and Obama. There won't be that many of those, because they won't agree on that many.
Yeah, three and one. Three presidentials, one vice presidential.
Yeah, I mean, there won't be. So once this is over, it's over.
What I thought they should have done from the very beginning is kind of had like a playoff. Since you had so many crazy people there, you know, just give them, because you can't possibly give them all enough time and really get into the depth of the insanity.
No.
You should have had a playoff. You know, Bachman and
That's cool. Paul
go the first week, and, you know, and then work your way up, kind of like have a bracket, so that we could, you know, we could participate in it, you know, like March Madness.
We've got Gary Johnson this time.
Well, because also there's more than eight now.
Yes, Gary Johnson made it in because he got 1% of support.
All right, because I saw McCotter dropped out.
Yeah, he's given up.
Yeah,
he couldn't get any support at all.
Couldn't get into the room. I mean, that's
no. And nobody knew he was running. And nobody knew he left.
Or Fred Karger. I mean, nobody knew he's in the room either.
No.
I mean, look, either one of those two, in my opinion, are as qualified as Michelle Bachman.
And Michelle Bachman is really over.
Well, yeah, her and her invisible friends. Her and her invisible friends can go on. I mean, that whole thing with the HPV thing. Oh, someone told me.
She jumped the shark.
Yeah, I mean, just kind of dumb to me.
That was when she jumped the shark. Yeah. She really did.
Yeah, well.
That was it.
All righty. Well, Victoria Jones, I always appreciate talking to you. Good news. Well, not really, but thanks for the news.
Thank you.
All right. Now to find out what's going on across the street. What do you got for us tonight, Jay?
Thanks, Rick. Interesting article from Mike Lillis from The Hill. An article about Representative Waters and some interesting things she had to say about the president. She apparently was at a Congressional Black Caucus Foundation annual legislative conference in D.C., and she said some almost provocative things. She said the president has been very nice about it. She's talking about Obama's budget negotiations with the Republicans. We love the president, quote, we want him to be successful, but does he feel our pain? Does he understand what's going on out here? Waters, who is a prominent member of the Congressional Black Caucus, said she's encouraged by the president's new proposal to create jobs and rein in deficit spending. Quote, I love the president, but I will ask the president, where's the money? Waters generated some real headlines last month when she said that the Tea Party can go straight to H-E-double-L. And on Thursday, she hadn't changed her tune. She was not apologetic. Yes, I was displaced in national media telling them where to go, and I mean that. And those are some strong words from a member of the Congressional Black Caucus. In the end, what she's trying to do is encourage the president, but at the same time hold his feet to the fire. And so far, I have to say, it's been successful.
The crew ethics list, the corrupt ethics list. So,
well,
I wonder about her and that.
What's the word? Politics makes strange bedfellows. Although I think her and Obama agree on a lot of things. I think she might have some problems there. I think that involves her husband, I believe.
Yep.
It appears that Mr. Boehner has some problems. He's criticized some of his fellow conservatives on a big vote yesterday. About four dozen House Republicans broke rank and opposed a stopgap spending measure, killing the bill after Democrats pulled their support. The vote gave leverage to Democrats who want more federal disaster funding and who oppose cuts to an energy program in the bill. The spending measure, which is known as a continuing resolution, including about $3.65 billion in federal disaster aid, All six Democrats opposed the bill because Republicans partially offset the disaster funding with about $1.5 billion cut to a Department of Energy manufacturing loan program, which, by the way, Rick, was supported by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So the U.S. Chamber is saying, hey, look, we agree with the Democrats on this vote. And here's the interesting thing. 15 Republicans voted against, who had voted for the debt agreement on August 1st, voted on Wednesday no. One of them, our friend Lou Barletta, from right up the line here, who's been soundly criticized for some of his previous votes. Democrats are demanding that Republicans scrap the offsetting cuts for the disaster aid, and they circulated a letter from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce opposing the cut to the energy program. Apparently, all those confrontational town meetings with the which the Republicans have borne, when they went back to their district, have borne some fruit. In fact, we have a couple friends of this program that were intricately involved in some of those meetings, and you know what? Apparently, it's borne some fruit. That's good stuff. I'm glad to see that there's some disunity among the Republicans. Post office. This is a sad tale. Post office has been under attack for whatever reason, and I haven't quite figured it out, Rick. I don't know if you can. There's been
privatization.
Well, I understand that. That's probably the ultimate aim of the Republicans. But why were there some burdensome restrictions put on? I believe they were required
to destroy them,
to fund the fiduciary responsibility as far as it has to do with retirements 10 years in advance, which I understand no other federal department has had to. So we have, some real budget fights. The lawmakers sparred at a recent House Oversight Subcommittee markup over what is needed to clean up the agency's finances. The GOP bill was approved by the subcommittee in an 8-5 vote Wednesday evening. UPS has said that it will not make a $5.5 billion prepayment for retiree health care costs that is due at the end of September. The stopgap spending measure that the House rejected Wednesday would have pushed off that payment until mid-November. The GOP's proposal would do three things. Now, listen to this. And you talk about privatization. This is what the Republicans want to do. They want to reduce it to five-day delivery. In some areas, Rick, believe it or not, they want to eliminate door-to-door delivery. And they want to create a new commission to recommend post office closings and other cost-cutting measures. So they want to shut down some of the offices. They want to eliminate door-to-door in some areas. And they want to limit it to 5 days.
You lie! You hate America!
Under the Democrats' bill, introduced Wednesday at the same time, U.S. Post Office could branch out into other areas to bring in fresh revenues like check cashing, and I have to think about that proposal, and facility leasing. In addition to that, you have the Obama administration that's come out with a third proposal. They unveiled its own plan. They unveiled its own plan to help the Post Office this week. Under their plan, the government will return about a $6.9 billion overpayment in their federal retirement program to the agency over a two-year span, while in the House GOP vote, unfortunately, they have recommended transition to a five-day delivery. But the Republicans in the House oversight have questioned the administration's assertion that its proposals would cut billions. In the end, the oversight Republicans believe that the president's blueprint actually raises deficits to another $10 to $20 billion, and therein lies the crux of the matter. I like the Obama administration proposal, except going to 5 days. It is a shame. You're talking about the elimination of, in the end, hundreds of thousands of jobs, and it's obviously done for political purposes.
You lie!
I think the post office, for the most part, is one great deal. Where in the world can you get something sent thousands of miles and have it delivered within days for, what is it now, 43 cents?
I say we just drop it down to one-day delivery. Once-a-month delivery. Get all of it in one big bundle.
Well, you're being facetious, but there's a real attack on these people, and can you imagine if we privatized what the nightmare that would be?
Go back to Pony Express.
Oh, my. And you can bet, no matter what the Republicans say, that your cost would be raised substantially.
Go back to the first letter you got on the Pony Express.
I get you.
We're right back after this. Stick around.
America. Rick Smith.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing, to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Texas is a right-to-work state. Texas is a great state. We could be the Texas of the Northeast.
They're selling make-believe and we don't buy that here. Cause in the real world they're shutting Detroit down.
We could be the Texas of the Northeast. That scares the hell out of me. Oh, man. In fact, it scares the folks in Canada as well. According to the Borowitz Report, Canada warned today that if Governor Rick Perry of Texas is elected President of the United States in 2012, it will take the regrettable necessary step of constructing a 20-foot fence along the entire border with the U.S. So they are going to build a 20-foot electrified fence to keep us out. Canadian Border Security Minister Ian McGlarity said this is a step that we don't take lightly. However, we must protect ourselves from the prospect of millions of Americans pouring over our border. Mr. McGlarity said that the Canadian border officials were alarmed by the volume of panicky comments regarding Americans' migratory plans in the event of a Perry win, posted on websites ranging from the National Public Radio to Huffington Post. He went on to say, "We are taking this threat very seriously. We will electrify the fence if necessary." Perhaps taking the lead from Canada, Mexican officials said today that in the event of a Perry victory, it would install toll booths in its secret underground tunnels, which would require travelers to provide documentary evidence that they are members of a drug cartel in order to gain entry into Mexico. At a campaign stop in Florida today, Governor Perry addressed the prospect of an electrified fence being erected on the United States northern border, where he said, my position on electrocution
is a matter of public record. I'm for it. So there you go. He's all for electrifying fences and electrocuting people on them. So there you go, the Borowitz report. This grabbed me. There's evidently a house in New York that's 990 square feet. Somehow they put three bedrooms, two bathrooms, and four fireplaces in this tiny 990-square-foot house that is 9.5 feet wide. It is the narrowest house in all of New York. 9.5 feet wide. It is being put up for rent for $14,000 per month. A 990-square-foot house. Think about this. 990. This is a tiny, tiny house, 9.5 feet wide, $14,000 a month. They estimate the worth of the house at $4.3 million. Evidently, it was the former home of Cary Grant and Margaret Mead and Edna St. Vincent Millay. You know who she is? Of course you do. And John Barrymore as well. So this little tiny house, $14,000 a month. If I got to pay $14,000 a month to live in New York, I'm leaving. I mean, that's more than a lot of people make in a year. That's amazing. Here's another example of why San Francisco is looked on with a jaundiced eye. Evidently, they're going to have a nude inn. It's going to draw a number of nudists to the corner of Castro and 17th Street, according to UPI. The organizers said the naked people will gather at the location dubbed the Buff Shop at about noon on Saturday to celebrate the coming of Sunday's Folsom Street Fair, which stretches across the 13 blocks of the city and celebrates nudity, leather fetish, according to the San Francisco Chronicle there. And I'm, you know, the guy who's going, 65-year-old George Davis, guy who challenged the mayor out there back in 2007, he said that the nude inn is about drawing attention to the fact that public nudity is legal in the city. Great. George, nobody wants to see you naked. Nobody.
So and, are you moving out there?
No. No. Look, nobody.
Well, I'm sure
nobody like you. Nobody wants to see me naked either.
I'm sure that there's thousands of our listeners that were anticipating that answer.
Whatever, but at the end of it, that's another reason that they get kind of weirded out. And hey, in Japan, Yokohama, evidently there's going to be a new museum opening up to my favorite college food. That's right, Cup of Noodle. Cup Noodle is having a museum with their whole line of ramen noodle products. So all of you who are pastafarians like me, worship at the bowl of ramen noodle. There is now going to be a museum. Nissan Foods said the museum, which opened to the public Saturday, includes the history of the product, which was created by the founder Momofuku Ando back in 56 and has fed millions of college kids ever since. So there you go. Anyway, had a great program tonight. I hope you enjoyed it. If you missed any portion of it, thericksmithshow.com is where you can go to catch the rest of it. And if you've got a smartphone, you can download the Stitcher app, Stitcher, and take your program with you. If you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, I do answer all emails personally. Tomorrow noon, we're going to be out in Hershey. You can do a little marching, a little protesting, a little screaming, hollering, whatever pops up. I'm going to bring you that tomorrow night, of course. Tomorrow night we're going to talk with Joe Markosik, state representative, about the transportation bill. So much coming up tomorrow. You're not going to want to miss it. Back here at 9 o'clock. Don't miss it. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's color like the tide flood beneath the blur sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming. Today, yes, hey.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
I teach at the middle school. I find it hard to catch my breath. The kids are scattered. Parents are frantic. All worried about the tests. But is it my fault that the scores aren't higher? The kids are so misbehaved. They took my aid. My class keeps growing and the board won't flip back my pain.
And a shitstorm let loose inside the West Bank. If anybody so much as